going to open the House Interim Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources. Thanks for being here today. First of all, we'd like to have, I'm going to open an informational hearing. There he is. And then my co-chair will finish the informational hearing. He had a birthday, so please excuse him.
Yeah, it was a little slower. Caucus and then sleep. It was just thrilling. Great day. Okay, I'm going to ask Tom Tuckman to come up. Governor's Forestry and Conservation Finance Advisor. Interesting. Well, we asked Tom to come just so we could, he doesn't have a lot of time today, but just so we could meet him and then have maybe longer conversations about what you're working on. This committee is certainly interested in forestry issues. The governor's been in front of us to talk particularly about his desires around federal forest policy reform. Told us at the time he was hiring you, and so we were all thrilled to hear you were on the job, and at some point like to have deeper conversations about what you're finding and what you're working on. But initially just wanted to meet you.
Great. Pardon me. I'm learning the commute down to Salem, so I ran in here. Unfortunately, started a few minutes late. I spoke with Ms. Herzog and suggested that I talk a little bit about a few minutes on my background and some of the priorities I have on behalf of the governor, and then would love to get together either at another committee hearing or privately and talk a little bit more about that in detail. So, members of the committee, thank you very much for the invite to join you today. Tom Tuckman with my company is U.S. Forest Capital, and we're a conservation finance company, and the governor has retained us to help with some of the priorities related to forestry, federal forestry and state forestry. I know you're going to hear a lot more from the state forester, Mr. Decker, and others about some of the issues. But by way of background, I've got background in the public sector, the private sector, nonprofit sector, knocked around on a lot of Oregon federal forestry issues for 20, 25 years. Primarily the priorities that the governor has and would like me to work on are really threefold. The first is, and I know you're very familiar with it, issues related to the ONC lands, the 2.1 million acres that are owned by the BLM. There's another 465,000 acres. People don't realize this, 465,000 acres that are managed by the Forest Service, but they're actually ONC lands. And so payments to those counties are based on the 50% payout versus the 25% on the Forest Service. So there's a total of about 2.5, 2.6 million acres of ONC lands that are subject to federal forest policy. That's the top priority for me. The governor's made it very clear that's the top priority for me right now. We're working hard on that. I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that if you'd like. In addition to that, the conservation finance piece of my work is related to the changes in timberland ownership and actually, to some degree, agriculture ownership in the state. And what I mean by that, this is sort of an amazing statistic, but between 1985 and 2008, I think were the statistics we looked at, 84% of the nation's industrial timberland changed hands. That's an amazing statistic if you think about it, for an asset class to go to changed hands. And it was driven by, and I think this committee has heard about this in the past, it was driven by incentives and the integration, the de-aggregation of integrated companies that own timber as supply for mills and looking at timber as an independent asset class. And what that's done is created a lot of changes, a lot of fragmentation throughout the forest asset class. And I think the feeling is that we've got regulation, we've got incentives in terms of public acquisition programs, but can you come up with private capital-type solutions to keep these lands in working for us? And how do you do that? And I worked with this committee with my other hat on 4 or 5 years ago to pass the community with Representative Burley and then Senator Westland to pass a community forest authority bill. I think the governor is interested in picking up on that and seeing what else we might do in the state. And then the third area of focus is community collaboratives. There's been a lot of work. They take a long time bringing industry, conservation community, local elected officials, others together. But it's amazing what happens when they work. You guys have heard about the potential closing of a mill in John Day. Mm-hmm. It's amazing the people rallying to keep that mill open on all sides, and so the governor has an interest in promoting those. I should add a fourth priority, value-added manufacturing and biomass. What can we do to keep wood-related facilities and jobs here in Oregon in this increasingly international market? So that's fundamentally what we're working on right now, and with a big priority on ONC lands, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I know you've got a busy schedule today.
Any questions for Tom now? Co-chair Esmal.
What exactly do you have in mind on the ONC lands? That's very, very important to our counties that receive those benefits, and my memory serves me correct. We were getting originally 75% of the yield, and then that went down to 50%. And I believe that's where we're at now, but the diminishing harvest has made it to the point of, well, you have 50%, but 50% of nothing is still nothing. And now the federal government is more or less reneging on their agreement with the ONC counties. They said they would go ahead and supplement the payment. Now they're pulling that back, but they still aren't opening enough timber cut to sustain our counties. And some of these counties face not only critical, but they're going to be bankrupt if we aren't real careful with what we do with that situation. How can we get that back into the sovereignty and the control of the state of Oregon, or can we?
Mr. Chairman, I think you outlined the issue very succinctly, and you're correct. I mean, technically, the way it worked was the original ONC Act said that 75% of gross revenues would go to the county. My memory, I don't recall specifically, but I think it was in the 50s, that they took 25% of that and said that it was going to be plowed back into resource management activities, and so it went back to 50%. So I think since the 1950s, if my memory serves me correctly, the counties have been receiving 50% of gross revenues. On Forest Service lands, it's 25% of gross revenues. And one of the unique aspects of the ONC payments is that those funds can go to the general fund, whereas on the Forest Service payments, it's targeted to, I think, it's targeted to roads and more limited activities. And so it's a very, very important source of revenues for rural Oregon counties. For 30 years, well, ONC county payments didn't really start to take off until the 1960s. Even though the act passed in 1937, there weren't a lot of payments until really the late 50s, early 60s, when timber harvest started to increase dramatically, not just in Oregon, but throughout the West and throughout the country. And then it went up and down based on market conditions until the late 70s. In the late 70s, a law was passed that sort of started to even those out. And then in the early 90s, with the implementation of Northwest Forest Plan, there have been a series of county payments, to make up for the difference between the low timber harvest levels and historic payments. So after 18 years, that a lot of people are concerned that that's coming to an end, and that's the primary reason the governor has gotten involved in this. I mean, he has outlined a number of principles, including he wants an adequate level of payments to the counties to provide for basic humans, basic services. He wants a stable timber supply. He wants some sense of certainty those two things will be achieved. He wants to implement a number of the conservation provisions of the Northwest Forest Plan, and he would also like to make sure that. I would say it this way. Whatever we do here needs to be budget neutral at the federal level. I mean, the concern at the federal level is there's not going to be a lot more spending on these programs, so we need to come up with a solution that is budget neutral. The governor is putting time and effort into this. He's obviously retained us to help him on this. We also have to realize that this is a federal program. I mean, this is going to be an Oregon delegation. It's going to be up to the administration to make some decisions on this. But we feel, the governor feels that if we can reach a solution here at Oregon, that there's a good likelihood that we can push for its passage in Washington, D.C. It's going to be really hard. I don't want to, you know, it's going to have to be through, because the policy makes sense, not just here in Oregon, but also in Washington.
Follow up. My thinking on this whole issue is that we have logged in this state now for 100 plus years. And I've heard people talk about getting a trust. I think what I would like to see us maybe think about, and you can think about it, is to take the lands that have been logged in the last 120 years, outline a harvest plan for those, start in the older stuff and work your way into a 120 year yield and harvest plan. So after 100 plus years or so, you're actually not only perpetually taking the renewable resource that this state has, mm-hmm. but more importantly, you'd be what they'd quote old growth. You would be taking stuff that's 35 to 45 DBH and harvesting that and utilizing it as a crop instead of what we do now. And now it's kind of a cloud of dust in 3 yards. We go in and we log and then we walk away from it, and it's been very adverse not only to the wildlife but also to the forest in the aspect of fire danger. I would like to consider something like that if we could possibly do that, because it just makes sense. It's a crop. It's renewable. It's one of the few renewable resources Oregon has. The other one is water. And those are the only two actual natural resources we have that's renewable. So we should utilize it.
Mr. Chairman, we are finishing our discussions with a variety of different parties. We want to work closely with the legislature. Be happy to meet with you and get more detail on your proposal, and we can consider that. I would say, and I know this, these are federal lands. They're managed under a multiple use mandate. There are national environmental laws that need to. All these proposals need to be considered in that context, and the question is can we come up with something here in Oregon that balances, it's an oft-used word, but balances those different components. The governor has said he wants to see an adequate level of timber supply, an adequate level of payments to counties, and you know, we need to look at doing things differently. He also indicated that he wants to look outside the box. So you've got some good ideas on that, and we can certainly discuss those.
Thank you, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forgive me for being late. Good morning, sir. How are you? Forgive me for walking in late. Let's just assume for a moment this is 100% of sustainable yield on state lands. This is 100% that the scientists from up in Portland decided was 100% sustainable. Let's just assume this. So we're only cutting at this level on our own land. And the governor was here. We had a nice conversation some time back. This is how much why we're not here, I do not know. You're his advisor. You should advise him, in my opinion, to cut at this level. This is 100% of what's sustainable according to the science. Whoever science, I don't know, pick somebody out. So if we're only logging at this level on our own land, why should some pinhead from Rhode Island care about what we do on federal land? It's just absurd to me why we're not logging more on our own land. And by the way, this is 100% of what they say sustainable. I understand this is sustainable. That's what I've been told by smart people that actually work in the forest and know what they're talking about, in my humble opinion. And my question is, I want you to define what adequate yield is. How many million board feet is adequate? Do you have a number? That's my first question. I have a second one. Do you have a number for what adequate is?
The governor has not indicated a number yet.
Yeah, well then, forgive me, Mr. Chair, then it means nothing. And we're going to have anarchy in rural Oregon because they don't have enough money to pay a sheriff to go out and respond to some woman who's getting beaten by her crazy husband. So that's exactly what we have, sir. We have no money to provide services in those counties. And people in Portland and this valley don't care about those people. They don't care. They like this little idea. They can run through the forest picking flowers and smoking their medical marijuana, and that's okay with them, and let those people starve. That's exactly the state we're in right now. What does the governor think about our good friends, Congressman DeFazio, Walden, Schrader, Bill, in Washington? And what's your advice to him on that?
Representative, understand your concerns and your frustration.
I don't think you do understand it, sir, but go ahead, forgive me. What's your answer to the question?
We're beginning a process that we hope will be completed by November to bring Oregonians from different parts of the state together, from the industry, from the counties, from the environmental community, to try and build on the DeFazio bill so that when Congress reconvenes next session, there's a high likelihood of passage.
Is he supportive or not?
He has said that it's a good start and he wants to build on it.
All right, thank you.
Anything else? My hope is that we will be able to get Mr. Tuckman to come back. So at this point, I think we'll hold off further questions because we want to have a longer conversation. But
I'm sure you do.
Depends on your time,
Chair,
and somebody's behavior, my good friend.
If you schedule in January, he'll probably come back.
Exactly. You'll be a citizen.
I am. I've always been a citizen.
Shout from the corner.
Yeah. Probably be more effective out there. That seems the way it works around here.
Thank you for coming in. We look forward to continuing to work with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Okay. Okay. And this is all informational meetings, so I don't have to do any of that business the entire time. That's great. So I'm going to ask Newhall to come up. Just for background for committee members, Co-Chair Esquivel and I invited the U.S. Department of Labor to come and talk to us about an issue that's been going on this summer, in particular, involving some enforcement activities they've been doing. And they, I believe their response was they cannot. Certainly they won't. They couldn't today, but I believe they also indicated they can't or won't appear in front of a legislative committee. So the best we could do was ask our State Department of Labor, who is not necessarily in the same, has the same view about these practices, but at least could tell us potentially what they know about it, because we couldn't get the Federal Department of Labor. Apparently they may set up some briefings we could call into where we could ask real questions, because there's a lot of information flying around and it would have been really helpful to have them here to ask them directly, so we don't assume that, I've only heard one side of the story, the farmers. There may be another side of the story, but without them to ask, it's difficult to get to the truth. So we'll just do our best here for 5 minutes or so from what you know, and then we'll have these briefings. Hopefully we can get set up for those of us who want to call into.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I requested our administrator to request the written law that prohibited these people from coming in front of this committee. I don't know if we've received any response on that at all.
Chair Esquivel and Chair Kleiman, committee members, I did make that request, and they are going to get back to me with something, I believe, in writing explaining their position. So.
Okay, but Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I don't want anything of their rhetoric. I want to see
a statute.
Law.
That's right. I understand, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I did have a conversation with a congressman yesterday who's been working on this and said we would like some help.
Getting we've got answers. Help. Our whole delegation signed a letter.
They're having some challenges getting meetings as well, by the way, apparently. And
that's
so
unbelievable.
At some point, just for fact-finding, it would be helpful if we could figure out a way to go to their briefings or something, because I've already heard that there are other elements of a story, that some of the things that I have heard initially, there's another part to it, so it would be helpful to get to talk to them. So sorry that we could not get our preferred first guest, but you've got a letter from Commissioner Vakian and his deputy here to chat with us briefly about something that's not your policy, I understand.
Thank you, Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Clem. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall. I'm the Legislative Director at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. You flatter me, second tier. As you guys know, the Bureau of Labor and Industries is the state's labor law enforcement agency. We enforce civil rights laws that protect Oregonians from discrimination, both in the workplace, in housing, and public accommodations. We also enforce the state's wage and hour laws, which are govern minimum wage, overtime, meal and rest periods, and child labor. Our agency is headed by the Commissioner of Labor and Industries, who is our state's chief labor law enforcement officer. I am here today at the committee's request to share with you concerns that the Commissioner of Labor and Industry has raised with the U.S. Department of Labor's recent use of the hot goods provision here in Oregon. And thank you, Co-Chair Clem. I do not speak for the U.S. Department of Labor, and I don't claim to be an expert in federal labor law. But just as background, our understanding of the hot goods provision is that it's a provision in the Fair Labor Standards Act that prevents the movement or shipment of goods that have been produced in violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. And that would include, again, minimum wage, child labor, overtime. It also allows the U.S. Department of Labor to seize goods that have been produced in violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. The original intent of this law, going back to, I think, 1936, is to prevent the unfair competition of goods that have been produced in violation of labor laws from competing against goods that have been produced lawfully. And at BOLI, we know labor law violations are something that happen every day. We see it. We know it all too closely. Discrimination is still alive and well in Oregon, and wage theft does indeed exist. But when we heard about the hot goods provision being used here in Oregon recently, this summer of 2012, the commissioner had some immediate concerns with the use of the hot goods provision, particularly on agricultural products. And the concerns that he raised, as you guys all will see in his August 15th letter to Secretary Hilda Solis, was concerns about the lack of due process that was available under hot goods and the perishable nature of agricultural products. So I think, again, we recognize that enforcement agencies need strong tools to enforce labor laws, but we also believe that this has to be a fair and judicious process and that employers have to have the opportunity to defend themselves before enforcement actions are taken. In his letter to Secretary Solis, the commissioner asked the U.S. Department of Labor specifically to cease using hot goods orders here in Oregon on agricultural products. Since sending that letter, I know the congressional delegation has also expressed concerns with hot goods and the use of these orders on agricultural products. Again, we recognize that there may be appropriate uses of hot goods provisions, but we think that agricultural products are very different because of the spoilage factor. We are currently in conversations with the U.S. Department of Labor. We're in the process of gathering more information about how this process was used here in Oregon. And I would say at this point are having good conversations and still waiting for a formal response to the commissioner's request and getting more information about the process. So in closing, I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee has. I want to be careful, though, to say that I can't really answer specific questions about hot goods. I'm not the U.S. Department of Labor. Again, I sort of look forward to those continuing conversations and getting that more information. And also to say that I think it is important that agencies have strong enforcement tools. We do see wage theft every day at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I think we have to have the right and the right tools to appropriately enforce. But I think we also have to make sure that there is due process and there is the opportunity to defend against allegations being made. With that, we're happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Kate, Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It really isn't much of a question. Thanks for coming, Kate. I'm glad Brad, I'm really grateful for Brad coming out in the position he did. I mean, he's no right winger, we all know that, and he cares about workers as much as anybody. I think what needs to be remembered, somebody didn't get paid here, but according to what I know, someone didn't get paid the right rate. I think I'm confident the vast majority of growers are honest, decent people, and they treat their workers like family. And you can go no farther than people like Senator Thompson, who literally has had people on his living on his property for decades. They are. He went to one of his workers' daughter's wedding the other day. Just talked to him about it last night, and I believe it's going on every day. But I don't think it's every grower in the state, on the contrary, the majority of them are paying the right wages. And these folks can work, they're hard workers. I understand that the federal government assumes people only make, can only pick X amount, when there's hard workers out there that can do 2X, and they say, no, that's impossible. That's what, according to some anecdotal stories I heard last night. But I got to tell you, and I also understand that this company, this is not a repeat offender. And they came in and seized these goods, and every when the clock's ticking, money's going down the drain because of it. But I'm just going to make one more comment. We had the, I'm surprised that a federal department wouldn't come and speak to this committee, because we had the Environmental Protection Agency in front of Business and Labor in 2011. To be quite frank, it didn't do any good. They didn't answer any questions. They just rambled on and gave us definitions of terms we already knew. That's pretty much all they provided with us anyway. So I don't think we're really out much. But, Kate, I do appreciate you coming. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Representative Toffler. And I think that you hit on exactly the concern that we are raising, is that the hot goods order can be placed before the employer has had the opportunity to fully defend themselves against the allegations. And I think, like I said, I know that there are wage violations out there and wage theft, but I also think in enforcing our wage and hour laws, it's important to make sure that everybody has due process.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I'd like to read the questions that our congressional and senator contingency of the state of Oregon wrote to the Department of Labor. The question is, the four questions, is it the policy of the Department of Labor to not disclose alleged violations to employers before issuing hot goods? That's number one. Number two, what test or standard is the Department of Labor using to determine the need for hot goods order? Three, why does the Department of Labor ask employers to waive rights for future findings of facts or law in its consent judgments? And the fourth one, what opportunity is there for an employer to respond without having his or her perishable crop under threat? I think those are four very good questions.
Well, I just want to end this on a good note. In my district, we have an organic blueberry farm, very small, about a half acre. The best berries going, and you can pick them or they can pick them, and they are the best ever, and I don't think they have any. It's an owner-operated thing. It's all the signs as you head west on 26 before you get to Buxton. And I also want to lift the warning on everybody. Your briefcases are safe. All the zucchini from my yard are now divvied up. You can come in the office without worrying about that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last point that the co-chair makes, on this, I would want to advise the committee that it's not always the federal government that forces the individuals into uncompromising types of positions by having to sign off on things. I could spend probably quite a bit of time, given a few hours to do some research, of illustrations that I've had where state agencies, state of Oregon agencies, have done exactly the same thing. I'm not talking about Boley, on this issue, but quickly reminded of an incident on the Oregon coast where one of the oyster farmers, in order to keep their license, had to sign away their right to appeal.
That's wrong.
And that seems to be the heavy hand of the bureaucracy falling on people. That doesn't make me very happy that we're facing this problem as far as the federal government is concerned here, but I do think it's the responsibility of the legislature to probably look at our own house areas, in these areas as well. So, and I don't want the fact that we do it to exonerate the feds, you know, in the process. For us merely to recognize that it seems to be endemic in government to use that particular approach.
Okay, thanks, Kay. I will note for the record, you've got a another letter from the Northwest Workers' Justice Project. It's got a good article that the labor press did that kind of describes some of the commissioner's positions and some of the issues involved, and then another letter that this is why I would have liked to have the Labor Department here, because there are some conflicting opinions about how hot goods can be used. Can it actually retain crops, or just the value of crops? And so I would have loved to ask them those questions, but we don't have the opportunity. So you have some information here that can lead us to further, I think, questions and dialogue if we get the opportunity for a phone briefing or something like that to understand how this works. And certainly, as somebody who you know, has an interest in agriculture operation that just finished paying $30-some an hour, when people cheat and don't pay their fair minimum wage, it certainly doesn't help the rest of agriculture do that. And so I don't think anybody in the farm community is interested in protecting people from fines and those sort of things. It's the question is, before you get to the fine, did you definitely do what you shouldn't have done? And if so, you need to pay, because the rest of us do pay. And we're not interested in harboring people who don't.
We're also not interested in making people guilty.
Yeah, right. That's a due process issue.
I mean,
you've
got to
get to the facts first. Okay. Thanks, Kate, for coming in. And we're almost back on schedule. And let's see if we can get Doug Decker to kick the rest of our day off, which is all forestry all the time from here on out.
Very good. Good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Clement Esquivel, members of the committee. My name is Doug Decker. I serve as Oregon State Forester and Director of the Department of Forestry. We have all been looking forward to having this time with you this morning to describe some important work that we have underway in service to Oregon's forests and to Oregonians. I'm proud to be here with my executive team, who will be you'll be hearing from this morning as we walk through the subjects that you've expressed interest in related to fire and state forests and private forests and forest health. So we have a number of presentations lined up for you. I know we're good till about 10:45, and we'll welcome your assistance, and I will as well try to help us manage the time as we go through there. Before we started, I wanted to take a moment in opening here to convey our emphasis on the linkages between the economic and the social and the environmental benefits of Oregon's forests. Each depends upon another, and as an agency, we clearly understand that and appreciate that the health of our rural communities, just like the health of our forests, really does depend upon, in large part, on the role of active forest management, of good forestry, of sustainable practices. The work that we're going to be describing here this morning for you, whether it be in preventing and in fighting fire, or whether it be in ensuring compliance with the Oregon Forest Practices Act, or whether it be in managing state forests, has at its core a common theme of that really links healthy forests with people, with communities, and with economic health. So also just in opening here, I wanted to convey my own personal appreciation to your administrator, Beth Herzog, who has done an outstanding job on your behalf, focusing on the issues and learning the landscape of forest policy. She's actually attended most of the recent Board of Forestry meetings, both here in Salem and in the field, and has met as well with our local fire protection associations. Her personal knowledge and the strong working relationships that we've developed, I think, will serve you well. Beth also has probably shared with you that a couple of us from our team are going to have to step out here for a while to appear before a concurrently scheduled meeting of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee focusing on the Clean Water Act. And I apologize for that. Peter Doherty and I'll be stepping out, but hope that you'll understand. Beth has been very good in working with her counterpart, Beth Petrino, and the committee leadership to minimize the disruption. So I think that'll be coming up in the next 20 minutes or so. Our division chiefs will be carrying the key components here of the presentation. So while I'll be here at the table to help answer questions and also watch the clock, they'll be providing the detail for you. We do have, it's kind of a PowerPoint-based discussion. And when I step out, I've asked Deputy State Forester Paul Bell to anchor the spot here at the table. We're going to first focus on providing you an update on fire season here in Oregon, as well as some potential changes that are underway right now to Oregon's fire funding system. We'll next provide a focus on state forest management, give you an update on our forest planning effort, also on the Gilchrist State Forest. We'll be joined then by our friends from the Department of Agriculture to talk about sudden oak death and other invasive species. And then we're going to close with a report for you on the rebuilding of capacity to enforce and administer the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Along the way, we'll welcome your questions and conversation. So with that, I think we're going to kick off here with fire and fire season update. And so we'll ask Fire Division Chief Nancy Hirsch to join at the table here. And off we'll go.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch. I'm chief of the Fire Protection Division for Oregon Department of Forestry. Appreciate having the opportunity to be here with you today. And at the moment, I'm glad to be out of the refrigerator in the back of the room and up here where it feels a little warmer. As Doug mentioned, there's a lot going on here today. And I know that there's typically a lot to cover with fire season underway and still underway. Recognize that there could be a lot stimulated from this presentation, and no doubt that throughout this morning we'll have time to touch on a number of the policy topics that emerge here. So first, a step back and looking at really what was the outlook for this fire season. And I do that primarily because the last two seasons have really been below average. This season was forecasted to be average, and what that meant for us is really an increase, a significant increase in activity that was forecasted. Key here, in my mind, then, is the question, were we ready for this fire season? And I want to emphasize that, yes, the Department of Forestry was ready. Critically to being ready is having an adequately funded base level of protection, which is really the fire department. And this year, this biennium, that began with the 50-50 funding between the private landowner and the general fund public share. That's important to maintain that, to have a successful overall fire department. Second to that, then, is our special purpose appropriation funded by the E-Board legislature that brings to bear the two air takers and the three helicopters that we use across the state of Oregon. Thirdly, really, those two components form the foundation and the framework that allow the state of Oregon to secure catastrophic insurance policy as well. So as we got into May and June and our seasonal workforce came on and we started doing our annual trainings, as you well might remember, down in the Southwest, starting in New Mexico, moving up to Colorado and other adjacent states, they had a very early fire season, in fact, a pretty devastating one. You saw hundreds of homes burnt in New Mexico as well as in Colorado. We were able to do two things. One, send about 70 people out of state during that time to contribute to those firefighting efforts. And that's a real positive for us in that it takes folks off of our budget, but it also allows us to maintain the qualifications necessary to stay on top of our game here in Oregon. The other backdrop to this season was the greatest potential for large fire growth that was predicted in Oregon's southeast high desert region, where drought conditions were expected to continue into the sixth year. To date, as you well know, those predictions have proven accurate, as in this area, and those dots represent those large fires that have occurred this summer and burnt over 1 million acres of land in this area of the state, a significant loss to ranchers, landowners, as well as the public. There's a lot here on this slide, and I just want to point out, we'll reference this many times, this point here is the Berry Point Fire, which was southwest of Lakeview, and we're going to cover that topic quite a bit as we move through the presentation. There's actually a lot that could be talked about here, but again, in the interest of being first up this morning, I want to save time for other policy topics. So, July, summer really ramped up for us, as it normally does here in Oregon, and it came in with a storm, literally. We received, for a period of 14 days, 2,000 lightning strikes per day. And going back to those dots in southeast Oregon, that million acres, that started a lot of those fires. For the lands that the department protects specifically, this first lightning event here in July resulted in a couple significant fires in our John Day country over in eastern Oregon. We had two fires that we were not able to keep at our target, our goal of 10 acres or less. One was the Briley Mountain Fire. The second one was the Stewart Ditch Fire. Those fires totaled just under 1,000 acres. Now, the fires that you read about or you hear about on your 5 o'clock news are usually the large, very devastating fires. But what you often don't hear about are the other 99% or 97% that we successfully, aggressively initial attack and keep small. And that's what these two photos represent. The one on the left is a photo of our Nugget Butte Fire, which was a great catch at initial attack. And the point here, what this represents is use both of our statewide air tanker on the left and one of our special purpose appropriation Type 2 helicopters. The fire on the right is a great example. It's the Elk Grove Fire. It's a fire that didn't have very good, or basically had limited access. So in a place like this, the combination, as well as on the left, you have to have the combination of the folks on the ground, the frontline firefighters, supporting that aviation support as well to really be effective at initial attack. Much like July, August came in with a lightning event as well. Obviously not as significant as the July storm, but this first circle here was the first of two lightning events in August. Point here, this storm on August 4th and 5th was the lightning event that ended up putting the Berry Point Fire on Oregon's landscape. It started on U.S. Forest Service land, and again, I'm going to talk more about that in a moment. By mid-August, another lightning event, which is that second circle there, was forecasted. The significant event, this significant forecast had all of us very nervous. We still had fires on the landscape, large fires across Oregon, not under ODF jurisdiction from the July storm. We had new large fires on the landscape from that first storm in August. And then what that creates is a complete drawdown of resources. Basically, you had what you had. And what that meant for the state of Oregon is that the 150 contract crews that our department coordinates for all use of, from all agencies, there were no crews left. Engines, not available. The air tankers, of course, we had our two air tankers, but the national U.S. Forest Service air tankers were being shared amongst multiple states. And there were no Type 1 helicopters or helicopters available on the call when needed list. That drawdown led to the governor declaring a state of emergency that allowed us then through Op Plan Smokey to put three Type 1 helicopters on the Berry Point Fire. In the end, the forecast did not result in as much lightning as was predicted, fortunately for Oregon. However, the lightning that I pointed out here in mid-August did start a fire up in the Hells Canyon area of Oregon. That's northeast Oregon. And as a result of that, 74,000 acres were burned. It started on, again, U.S. Forest Service land, burned on to private land that we protect, ultimately burned into the state of Washington, and then pushed south again towards the town of Minnehaha, and again touching on private land. So, again, the most significant fire for us this season has been the Berry Point Fire. It started on Monday, August 6th in the afternoon. This fire burned in total 93,000 acres. For reference, you can see the state of Oregon down here. Again, Berry Point was just southwest of Lakeview. This map on the left shows this line in here is the Oregon-California border. The fire started up here on the north end. And for the first couple of days, this first of all, I want to state that ODF worked hand-in-hand, side-by-side with the U.S. Forest Service from day one, initial attacking this fire. And in the first couple of days, this fire, wind on it, pushed it in all directions. Understand, you go back and you look at where the long-term drought existed on the landscape in this area. We had winds that pushed the fire to the north, to the east, to the south, to the west. We had private lands ultimately out here on this end, on this edge, and again up here, and again down here just north of the California border, and as well over here on the west side. As the complexity of this fire grew, a Type 2 team was called in to manage it. Ultimately, there were a number of incident management team transitions due to the complexity of the fire. In total, this fire burned 93,000 acres between Oregon and California. Unfortunately, in Oregon, over 11,000 acres of private forest land was burned. One of the challenges, one of many I might add, was the magnitude of the runs that this fire made, and that challenged us and collectively all of us to appropriately coordinate with the private landowners that were impacted and or lands that were threatened. Early in that fire, we formed we worked with the incident management teams to form a landowner liaison group, of which Collins Pine, who was the major landowner impacted here, as well as a number of small landowners, were a part of. We also had Travis Medema, who's in the back of the room and will be up here next, working for the district forester there, working directly with the team in support of the direction being provided to that team. Just want to emphasize here that the loss and the magnitude of loss here in Lakeview is significant. Collins Pine lost 25% of their ownership, and of course with that comes a lot of concerns about the log flow to their mill there locally, one of the few mills left in eastern Oregon, as well as the jobs in the community, the just plain day-to-day quality of air that impacted the community during this fire. And one key other issue is that we recognize and that we've already initiated conversations internally as well as with Collins Pines, and State Forester Decker and I will be continuing those conversations up and through the Forest Service, is the challenge was with folks not only on the team in terms of upper management, but down through to the front line, really having an understanding of the value of the resources that we are responsible for to protect for these private landowners, for the public, etc. So that was Berry Point. Want to turn then to a more recent initial attack success that we had in southwest Oregon. You know, here we are in September. As you well know, the conditions are still very ripe. Slate Creek, this is a view from above, obviously, was a great success, a fire that we aggressively initial attacked and were able to keep to about 154 acres. Obviously, the weather conditions have been significant. This fire had heavy fuels and very steep terrain. The final estimated cost on this fire is about $1.5 million, probably a number that makes your jaw drop, and it does so mine. But having said that, a fire of this size and this cost is much less than the $23 million 93,000 acre fire at Berry Point. Thus, again, the emphasis for us of achieving keeping fires small, reducing cost, as well as the resource loss. So statistically, where are we at to date? This slide shows year by year acres burned from 2002 through 2011. You can see in the bar chart, the bar on the left, that was 2002. In the last decade, our most significant fire year in terms of acres burned, to 2007 and now 2012 here on the landscape. To date, we've had over about 500 fires compared to about 1,000 that we normally have. We've burned, unfortunately, over 17,000 acres. 90% of those acres are the result of the Berry Point and the Cache Creek fire, which started both on U.S. Forest Service land and ultimately ended up affecting private. Large fire costs. Many folks in the room, and you as well, are familiar with the large fire deductible, where the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund pays the first $10 million, and after that, the general fund is has exposure for the next $15 million. Over the last 10 years, we've averaged about $10 million, so that's been coming directly from the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. The 2012 to date is just under $5 million in large fire costs, and we are not through fire season yet. As this slide shows, fire season continues. It feels a little cool in here today. It's hard to know that the east wind is blowing out there with the curtains closed. I know it's blowing, and so does the rest of the rest of the folks within the department. I put this up here to show you the magnitude of large fires that have been on the landscape this summer. A lot of the dots there that you see don't really represent the acres, but you can see the magnitude when you look at the polygons there from Berry Point over to these southeast Oregon fires where we lost over 1 million acres. The other point I would make here is we really were very, very lucky just here this past weekend. Sunday, the state of Washington experienced a significant lightning event. We're sitting here with the same fuel conditions, the same weather, and the state of Washington on Monday dispatched six new incident management teams and have about between 40 and 60. They don't even have yet a good handle on the amount of fire they have going on in the state of Washington. We've been spared on that storm. So challenges and opportunities. There's a whole lot I'd like to talk about. I'm going to mention three, large fire costs being the first one. It's been a long-standing challenge for us. As you look at the bar chart with an average of $10 million per year, this is something that will segue right into the conversation that Travis Medema will and I will talk about next. I also want to mention, just because this photo here represents fire in the wildland-urban interface, that still is an ongoing challenge. So far this year, we've been very, very lucky. But as I mentioned earlier, in New Mexico, in Colorado, the situation was significant loss with hundreds of homes lost. The third one I want to touch on is budget. The statewide severity resources, the two air tankers and three helicopters, are critical to us maintaining our success at keeping fires small. We're very prudent about management of those resources, but we are at very close to the end of our budget limitation. Both Paul Bell and I had a productive conversation with E-Board subcommittee yesterday. I feel like we have gained their support to continue to do the right thing and extend contracts where necessary, given the weather and the fuel condition that we have on the landscape right now. So getting close to the end here, September 7th slide here shows the extreme potential for significant fire here left right now in the state of Oregon. Weather forecast doesn't seem to be on our side right now. All I hear and what I see is a warming trend. I think we'll be in the 90s here today in the valley. Drier conditions. We've got the east wind, and as far as I can see right now, out 2 weeks, I'm seeing nothing but sunshine. So we are still in fire season. In wrapping up, As I said, fire season has gone as predicted. We've had a lot more activity and, unfortunately, more acres burned. That said, of those 500 fires, we have been successful in aggressively initial attacking and stopping a majority of our fires. We do that because we have a very positive, proactive, long-standing relationship with our landowner partners that are key to our complete and coordinated system by working with our cooperators and, in the end, keeping a majority of the fires small. As I said, large fire costs and loss remain to be a number one concern of mine, and that we are still in fire season. Your support is appreciated, as I mentioned, for the use and ongoing use of these statewide severity resources. Be happy to take any questions if you have any.
First of all, who names these fires? Who crack in the ground?
That's all there is here.
I mean,
that's
a location.
That's a geographic place name. That's a geographic place name. That's actually on the map.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Crack in the ground? Mm-hmm. Must be a hot spot. Yes.
Thank you, Nancy, for a great report. And I was just wondering the difference between the amount of money that we're at. You said now just under $5 million, but then you said that the Berry Point fire was $23 million. So is that just our cost is under $5 and the total cost with that's paid by insurance is the 23.
Representative Boone, co-chairs, members of the committee, that's correct. The under $5 million is the portion of costs borne by the protection on our lands. The $23 million would be in total for the cost of that fire, which the U.S. Forest Service will bear the majority of that.
Okay. Thank you.
90-plus percent of that.
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit on the same line of the inquiry, but the southeast Oregon, far southeast Oregon, where, a million acres in one fire or one group of fires, that sort of thing there. How much, if any, of that was on your watch, your land?
Representative Jensen, members of the committee, those lands in southeast Oregon are actually outside of our fire protection district boundaries. What is in play there are what is known as the Rangeland Fire Protection Associations. They are able to form under the Board of Forestry Authority. They have a very small amount of funding that comes through and by the legislature to pay for some insurance. They're basically groups of landowners locally that provide fire protection, neighbors helping neighbors. Because they form under the Board of Forestry, they are eligible for federal excess property. And so we also have in Eastern Oregon about a half-time funded person that coordinates. There's about 14 of these rangeland fire protection associations right now. And as a result of what happened here this summer, we've gotten a couple more requests for the formation of those. Those folks tied in with the BLM as those fires were being managed, and they are very well respected and work very hard under very severe conditions.
My following of this, and it just about choked my computer with all of the fire updates that I've gotten, this summer. But BLM was a major player in a lot of these fires, if I understood it correctly. From the fire reports, it sounded like they were, being fairly aggressive as they pursued this, which, memory serves me correctly, sometimes the federal agencies haven't been as aggressive, with fighting fire, and as a consequence, those fires sometimes get run over into our land as well. And, am I correct that we didn't see too much of a problem there, that we were everybody was kind of on the same page, or was that just my rose-colored glasses as I was reading the report?
Representative Jensen, members of the committee, there's a lot of information that speaks to folks working positively together. But when you have the magnitude of loss that's caused from a situation that did, like South, what happened here in Southeast Oregon, again, those fires were started again by lightning, and so there no doubt was chaos at certain points of time where you have multiple starts. You had significant winds and long-term drought fuels there. So I am also aware of challenges where folks didn't necessarily feel like things could have went as well as they could have, and just want to be clear about that.
Okay. I just editorialize if I could. I really appreciate the efforts that everybody has made this summer. That it is a tinderbox out there, and it's an incredible loss to us. I mean, we're seeing that loss. The Ag Committee may be looking at a variety of things in the future about the consequences of the lost acres. We've got a real problem for the ranchers, farmers there, of what to do with livestock because they don't have the acres to run them on. It has been a pretty disastrous summer in a number of parts of our state.
Excuse me.
So look forward to your continued good work with that, and thank you very much for your report and for the efforts that are being made.
Thank you.
I'd like to interject too and let you know that there was some people that were not pleased with the way we handled some situations in that Lakeview fire. In fact, they were on the radio saying allegations about the way we handled that. I would like to get with you or the department head and discuss those and let you air them out. It's unfair to spring that on you here, but I would like to discuss it with you and get some answers because they were pretty serious allegations. So,
yes. Mr. Yeah, I think you're overwhelmed. I don't think anybody can manage this, period. And can you go back to the last slide? I think it's telling the people that live in that white strip where there's no color, you know, but you talked about people don't understand the magnitude of this loss. Most of them live in that white strip. They don't understand the magnitude. And I'm grateful that my neighborhood isn't burning down, believe me, ma'am. And I don't got to worry about Fluffy the cat getting killed by some wolf, although I do understand that, too.
Or cougar.
Is there any evidence out there showing that if we allowed good people that want to make a living to go out there and thin or sustainably log some of this land, and is it choked with fuel? Is that one of the reasons why this is so bad, or is this just a natural event and there's nothing we can do about it, or a combination of both?
Representative Schaufler, members of the committee, we feel very strongly that active management is an important thing to do on the landscape, and that that the magnitude of fuels on the landscape from not as much management that we think could occur does influence the fire behavior and the magnitude of that.
Just let me get this clear, Mr. Chair. So the active management is lacking. Is that what
that's correct?
I understand is correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Nancy, for your presentation. And one of the things I want to talk just a little bit more about and get a little deeper in is the Berry Point fire. And I realize that started on Forest Service property, not state lands. But you talked about it starting, obviously, lightning strikes, which nobody controls that. Whether that's on private or federal or state, you don't control that. You do control the attack, but you don't control the initiation of it. So with that said, can you talk a little bit about if you have percentages or to the best of your ability, percentages of how much was Forest Service, how much was private? I didn't hear in there that there were state lands involved. Maybe I just didn't listen closely enough. A little bit about that. What I'm driving at here, and one of the issues and concerns that I take very, very deeply is the nature of land starting on private property, moving to federal lands, and that private landowner being liable. However, it doesn't work in reverse, and I have a big issue with that. So talk to me a little bit about that and that attack. I know you're not with the Forest Service, but you were involved in it. So talk to me a little bit about that, please.
Representative Springer, members of the committee, that, as I mentioned along the way here in the presentation, we work very closely with our cooperators and essentially have a strategy at the very local level, down to even a specific block of land where when a fire starts, the closest resources will go to that fire, irregardless of whether it's state or private or somebody else's. And so on this fire, when that fire was called in, it's my understanding that it went from being called in by someone in a lookout very near there to 20 acres in size and further very quickly. But Department of Forestry, local resources were involved from the initial phase of that initial attack on that fire. And in fact, I believe we had a person actually in charge as the incident commander in the early days on that fire. We utilized our air tankers. We had a state helicopter, as well as the federal agencies had as much retardant coming from their air forces as well, and helicopters. The magnitude, I'm sorry, one question.
We're going to have to get moving here. We're about 20 minutes behind schedule right now. So let's go ahead, Representative.
So what I'm getting at here is, and I appreciate that the state was on site first. I'm asking about when did the Forest Service show up roughly and with what resources, because certainly if I'm liable for something, I'm going to be all over it in a heartbeat. If I'm not, I'm not as motivated.
Both Representative Springer, members of the committee, it was a joint effort both by federal resources and state resources from the beginning of that fire, both aggressively initial attacking that. And it did start on federal land, ended up burning 11,000 plus acres of private land.
Wow. Okay, thank you.
And I'm
did
happy
she answer your question, Representative?
I think as well as we're going to get right now, so we'll follow up offline.
I'm not sure you answered her question.
We didn't get there. I heard you speak about time, so I will follow up later.
Yeah, you did not answer her question. Representative Johnson.
Just a quick question. I can take my answer online. But just about process, again, just to help me understand, maybe the committee too, about the chain of command and how it exists to determine where the assets are deployed, how many are deployed, in what quantity, that kind of thing, when a fire breaks out, just to understand the process better.
Okay.
I can defer the answer offline.
I think I can cover it pretty quickly,
okay.
Co-chair, members of the committee. When the fire starts at that initial attack phase, basically, again, closest forces show up, local resources. As that fire begins to grow, we go from initial attack into extended attack, where basically resources are called in outside of, you might say, Lakeview, from the nearest other locations like Klamath Lake and north of there. Resources will be coming in, as well as air resources anywhere from across the state. Once you get into extended attack and the fire becomes more complex, it's up to the local agency administrators, in this case, the district forester for Department of Forestry out of Lakeview, as well as the forest supervisor right there in Lakeview, would have made a decision to call in an incident management team. An incident management team is then delegated, basically the two agency administrators delegate the authority and provide the direction to that team on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you.
I appreciate the questions, and Representative Esquivel and Representative Springer, I'm happy to provide my number and some follow-up on your questions.
So you can also email people as well on the committee.
Mr. Chair, forgive me. This is overwhelming. There's no way you can manage this. It's impossible. And I think the thing we got to walk away and remembering is much of this can be prevented by managing this property, which is not being done, period. It's overwhelmingly obvious, but we're not doing it, Mr. Chair. It's not their fault.
We want, I guess, Mr. Decker. Where did he go?
We're
ready to transition to the Wildfire Protection Act, and I'm happy to keep
that.
Yeah,
we want to talk about fire funding.
Okay, I'll introduce this topic in wrapping up the fire season to date, emphasis there. As I mentioned, one of our largest challenges has to do with reducing really the number of large fires and reducing cost. And Travis Medema here, Deputy Chief of the Fire Protection Division, has joined me, and he'll be carrying most of this presentation. What we have in front of you is the Wildfire Protection Act, a legislative concept that the Board of Forestry has moved forward to the Governor's Office. And this bill and this act is really all about protecting and improving services to Oregonians. The history of this dates back to really about a year ago. The Board of Forestry met in Lakeview, Oregon, interestingly enough, and the Protection Division took to the Board some long-standing issues, one of those being the challenge and opportunity to try to reduce the number of large fires, another one being east side affordability of fire protection. The Board took that on and said, yeah, we think that is a number one priority to be addressed, and Deputy State Forester Paul Bell here on my left and I convened a statewide work group called the Fire Protection Funding Committee. That committee was represented by landowners throughout Oregon, small landowners and large landowners, the Cattlemen's Association, representative from the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, Oregon Small Woodlands, as well as Associated Oregon Loggers. Gary Springer, member of the Board of Forestry, was on that committee. We had Brett Brownscombe from the Governor's Office and representatives from Legislative Fiscal Office and Budget and Management. The Wildfire Protection Act is the product of the work group and endorsed by the Board of Forestry. So really, briefly, the broader policy context for this work and for this act is really all about keeping forests green, keeping working forests working. And with that, we'll move right into the legislative concept itself, and I'll turn it over to Travis.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, pleasure to be here with you today. For the record, Travis Medema, and I'm the Deputy Chief of Fire for the department, and on a detail assignment working on some special projects, of which this is one of them. Very happy to be here to talk about this with you today, and also tie it back into a bill that you all saw in the February session, which was House Bill 4042, and we were up having a conversation about that. So I want to make that linkage and tie it back to you. Chief Hirsch did an outstanding job in kind of outlining the policy context. I want to drill down just a little bit more into what some of the challenges were that led to the development of the Wildfire Protection Act. The first, kind of at the highest level, is all about protecting Oregon's forests. The department protects 16 million acres of forest land, of which 3.5 million is in the wildland-urban interface. And these lands are annually at risk from fire. As we saw earlier through Chief Hirsch's presentation, 3 to 4 months out of the year, just based off of where we're located at in the world and our fire season severity, these lands are at risk. And we reach conditions out of those 3 or 4 months every year where catastrophic fires are a possibility and a reality. Not only are these forests important to their owners, but they're important to our economy and a broad array of social benefits that Oregonians enjoy, such as clean water and clean air. And an adequate level of protection is a mechanism or vehicle to protect this $60 billion asset. The second challenge is how to reduce the number of large costly fires. So this is bullet number two up there. And large wildfires, as we heard earlier, can cost tens of millions of dollars. And aggressive initial attack and having the key resources, ground-based resources and air resources, are critical in complementing each other to put out fires before they become catastrophic. We've seen conditions across the West. We talked about Colorado and what's happened in New Mexico and Arizona and other states trending towards more severe wildfire seasons, and it points to a higher potential for Oregon and catastrophic fires. The third challenge is east side affordability. Currently, the lowest productivity lands are paying the highest cost of fire protection. They receive the most starts from lightning and have the least processing facilities. So when you combine and package all that up, it's a significant challenge to maintain working forests on the east side. Lastly, what the group tackled was equity across all three levels, and I'll show you a picture here in a minute of what that looks like. And really, it was, we know at the base level, and we've heard a lot about 50-50 and equity at the base level, but as you work up through the system, severity and who pays for large fires, equity does not exist, especially at the largest level, which is the large fire cost. And over time, forest landowners have carried the majority of the cost for large fires, and this concept gets at that. The Wildfire Protection Act and what we're talking about today restructures the current funding system, adds new funding in critical places, and it's really targeted to get at those challenges. So what does funding look like in Oregon for fire? And really, I like to try and explain it in three simple levels. Funding can get pretty complex when you talk about fire, different pots of money coming from different places, different matching dollars, but just at the real simplest, purest level, three tiers. The base tier is what I refer to as the fire department. That's the men and women that are out there in the infrastructure, the engines, that when the bell goes off, they run out the door, just like your local fire department. That's delivered through 12 forest protection districts to cover that 16 million acres. It's about 220-ish engines, dozers, and helicopters, once again, all geared at trying to put fires out at the smallest possible size. So that's the base level. The second level is statewide severity, and you heard Chief Hirsch talk quite a bit about statewide severity. That's the air tankers and the helicopter program. And those are really key in augmenting that base level and making sure that there's an adequate response when a fire breaks. And then the last is large fire costs and who pays for large fires, at what level, and how is it proportioned. And so we'll get into that a little bit more. So this is a pretty simple diagram and really geared at kind of those three levels. Once again, the base level is the bottom there. That's the fire department. There's about $41 million annually that are in the base department, and that's where the 50-50 relationship exists between private landowners and the state, and really where one of the east side challenges lies. So as we looked at developing a new concept, that's where the east side challenge lies at the base level. The second is the severity program, which is $2.2 million out of general fund and the special purpose appropriation that you all provide, and just absolutely critical to our success. And then the last piece is how are large fires paid for once you have a large fire and you weren't successful at the base or severity. And it's really a layered fashion in that one party pays first and then the next party, and then you access an insurance policy. So at the base level there, you see the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. Sorry for the acronyms. That's a big, long bunch of words that I couldn't fit in that little box. But that is purely landowner funding, and they're responsible for the first $9.5 million of large fire cost. Once that's expended, you then get into the general fund, which is $15.5 million, which in total is $25 million, and we often refer to that as the deductible. Once you've spent that $25 million, then you can access a one-in-a-kind, very unique insurance policy for another $25 million. So $50 million sit there in large fire costs and what's available to pay for large fires. Once again, the challenge is that it's in a layered fashion where one party pays first, then the next, and then you access an insurance policy. So knowing that we had challenges within this system, the group that Nancy explained really had to step back and holistically take a look at all three of those levels because they are very interdependent. What you do at the base level and the severity level definitely has an impact on large fires and if you have them and the costs that you would pay. So the group stepped back, took a holistic approach, and really looked at how would we restructure those. That all led up to this thing we're calling now called the Wildfire Protection Act, or the WPA for short, and it really addresses three key components, and these are the take-home messages behind this. The first thing that the Wildfire Protection Act does is it increases statewide severity, and the concept uses landowner funding to match basically the general fund funding and the severity program, which will be key in reducing the number of large, costly fires and the damages that private landowners receive. It limits this resource loss and helps maintain working forests, and then protects Oregonians and our key societal values, such as clean air, water, habitat, scenic values, and recreation. So this first component, which is increasing statewide severity, is really geared at stopping fires at the smallest possible size and adding landowner dollars to do that. The second piece is East Side Affordability, and it allocates limited funding to the lowest productivity timber and grazing lands on the east side,
which will help pay for the cost of fire protection and helps maintain Eastside Forest. And then the last component is, instead of a layered fashion for paying for large fires, it uses a phased-in approach or a dollar-for-dollar approach over time. Got a diagram that is a little busy, but I've tried to pull out the three key components we just talked about as highlighted colors. So the first component of the Wildfire Protection Act takes $1 million and allocates that to the four Eastside districts to help deal with the affordability issue. The second component is the $3 million of the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund that comes into the severity program to help add additional contracted resources. And then the last component of the act is the big block up there that over three biennia splits large fire costs over time, dollar for dollar, instead of a layered fashion. So when fully implemented, if we had a $4 million fire season, that $4 million wouldn't come out of just the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. It would be split $2 million from the State General Fund and $2 million from forest landowners. So a dollar for dollar approach for large fire costs. So what are the needed components to implement the Wildfire Protection Act? The first is, and we've had lots of discussion with the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund group that administers it, the EFC committee, about allocating $3 million annually, $6 million for the biennium into the severity program. They were very supportive of that. Once again, that's helping protect their interest and the state's interest in having large fires, a key component of the concept. The second component is it requires $1.6 million of new general fund to be placed into the existing special purpose appropriation. Once that would be accomplished, then $1 million would fall into the base level.
Can we just take a moment to welcome Representative Gilliam to the room?
Good.
Thank you, everyone. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you. Very good.
Sorry.
Is that really him?
We've heard about him. We've seen on the TV. But
it could be an actor posing as Representative Gilliam.
Yeah, that's right.
Did he bring a big check for $1.6 million with him?
Aren't you glad you
get some people
up
down there in Hollywood help us out up here?
Something like that happens. You don't just let that go by.
You got to capture the moment. That's what we're doing here. So then the last piece and a really key component is how do you share that large fire cost over time, and what the concept does, once again, is move to a dollar-for-dollar approach instead of a layered fashion where one party is responsible for paying for those costs before another. A key in this is that it does reduce the exposure to the general fund for large fire costs long-term. For the biennium, it's $9.4 million because we're moving that deductible piece that was $25 million down to $20 million. That $4.5 million to general fund is reduced, and the general fund wouldn't be liable for that in severe fire season. So that's another real benefit of the concept. However, the general fund likely would be paying for large fire costs throughout the year, which, unless we're in very severe seasons, have not done in the past. So only in very severe seasons when we spend over $10 million has a general fund paid. So if you move to a dollar-for-dollar approach, general fund would be at the table paying for a portion of large fires likely annually. The schedule of how that looks, the three biennia phase-in implementation is $2 million would be shared in 13-15 between forest landowners and the general fund, $10 million in 15-17, and $20 million in 2017, which would be dollar for dollar, $10 million from the fund and $10 million from the general fund. This concept was embedded in House Bill 4042 that was in front of you in the February session, this phased-in approach to sharing of large fire costs. So what would the outcomes be? The outcomes, you know, really benefit all Oregonians from our perspective. It lowers cost and exposure to our communities from wildfire, along with protecting our key forests. It makes investments up front and strategically gets firefighting resources that complement each other out on the landscape to help stop fires at the smallest possible size. And then it uses a limited piece of general fund, $1.6 million, and leverages $6 million of landowner funding, so leveraging dollars across the system. It addresses the Eastside affordability issue, maintaining working green forest, and then in totality creates equity across the entire system from the base level at 50-50 up through severity and how large fires are paid for. Next steps, this is a key department program option package. It's the number one for the fire program and something we've been working really hard on and diligently on. and it is the highest priority for fire. It's a well-supported concept by the Board of Forestry, by our stakeholders and others. We spent months and months, four different meetings and follow-up meetings working with stakeholders, cattlemen's, Oregon Forestry's Industry Council, Small Woodlands, and other constituents on this concept, and it's well-supported. We're currently working it up through the governor's recommended budget process now, and we've developed a work group of stakeholders that were instrumental in building this concept to kind of help shepherd it as we move forward. Some key folks on that are the Conservation Fund. We met with a Nature Conservancy the other day. County Commissioner Susan Morgan, ex-representative, she's a part of the coalition. And once again, we're all trying to work this up into the 13-15 session. And with that, and trying to save some time, Chair, I would end there and entertain any questions or try and provide clarity on this topic.
I have a question. How many times have we actually went over the threshold in the last 20 years? And have we ever been in excess of, say, $20 million, $25
million? Co-chairs, members of committee, that's a great question. We can get you the actual details. I don't have them on hand. Just off the top of my head, and Paul may step in, but 2002 was the last time that we accessed the insurance policy. So spent up through that deductible and then into the insurance policy.
So once in the last 10 years.
That's correct, Co-Chair Esquivel.
I need to understand how much we've consumed of that policy and what it costs per year for that policy, because I'm thinking if we don't attain that level very often, maybe we should be doing a dedicated funding in the state of Oregon and do our own.
Correct, Co-Chair Esquivel. The policy's been in place since 1973, and on average, we...
For the record, would you identify yourself?
For the record, I'm sorry, Deputy State Forester.
I got slapped here.
I'll take it for you. We get, since 1973, on average, we're into the insurance policy about every 7 years. Right now, we're in a 9-year run since we last accessed it.
Okay, but would you email this committee that information plus what it costs per year for the policy to see if that outweighs, see if it's beneficial?
You bet.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, will absolutely get that to you. We have a one-pager that talks through what we've paid in premiums and what the insurance payout has been, and it's about on par.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Travis, for your presentation. Going back to slide 4, you were talking about the challenges, and I almost hesitate in asking this question because it's not nearly as sarcastic as it might sound. You talked about processing, a lack of processing of facilities. I don't want to assume that you're just talking about mills. Are there something else that you're talking about? But to me, that sounds to me like a mill.
Co-chairs, Representative Springer, that's exactly what I was talking about, mill infrastructure, and I could be more clear about that. On the east side, the loss of that infrastructure has been a real challenge.
It's huge.
Yep.
Huge.
I will be much more clear about that.
No, I didn't mean that as a correction as much as am I missing a piece, but a mill's a mill to me.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. I just was going to follow up on your comments that... I think this body needs to take a very careful, examined look at the insurance $25 million insurance policy that we have, and whether or not it would be financially to our advantage to self-insure or to our disadvantage to self-insure. Understanding, of course, that there are not very many people that will write this insurance policy for us. Currently, I think it's Lloyd's of London, if I'm not mistaken. And none of the insurance companies are interested in writing insurance if it's a guaranteed loser for them. So it's a real delicate thing, but I think, you know, for you and me and our attitudes about what we're doing, we need to have feel some assurance that this is the correct thing to do. So I'd like to support you in trying during the next legislative session to take a very careful look at this particular issue.
Representative Shopper had his hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, forgive me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm grateful we haven't had a claim on our insurance since 2002. That's actually a positive thing. And it's been established here that the solution isn't putting out fires, it's preventing fires, and we're not doing that, and it's not your fault. But I find it interesting that, you know, we have some private landowners, 11,000 acres of their property burned, and the federal government isn't going to reimburse them for them, if I understand it right. Now we're going to go to those very same people and say, hey, give us some more money to put out these fires that we have a solution to prevent them with, and we're not doing it. It just, to the, and this insurance and the premiums has been an issue since forever, and I'm glad Susan Morgan is on this with you. She's about as knowledgeable as anybody I know when it comes to this kind of subject matter. Are the landowners supportive of this new money? And the co-chairs and the governor, where's $1.6 million going to come from in the general fund? It all sounds great, but do the landowners support this increase? Are they in support of that?
Oh, nodding.
I see some nodding in the background. Thank you.
Yes, they work this whole concept with us.
Yeah, great.
We're at the table the entire time helping us develop it.
And once again, Mr. Chair, my frustration is overwhelming because there's a solution here, a very simple one, and it ain't increasing somebody's premium. It's getting out there and managing this land, period.
Representative Schaffler, also I think that Co-Vice Chair Cowan, before she leaves her ways and means duties in her position, has found $1.6 million to just send via a little brown envelope to the department, if I heard that. I might be mistaken. And the other co-chair of that subcommittee, he's going to chip in a few cents, too, apparently.
I've seen them work miracles, Mr. Chair. God bless you.
Mr. Chair, it's amazing what the rumor mill tells you, and I might remind you that I am no longer co-chair of that subcommittee.
Oh, you got to another. It's the other.
The other one is needing money as well.
The other departing member who we should get some money from before she leaves.
We're closing down lumber mills, but there's no shortage of rumor mills.
Okay, are we ready to move into our next one, which will take some time? This is a forest management plan.
Chair Clement, members of the committee, next up for us will be Mike Borderlon, our division chief for State Forest, and to provide an update on our State Forest Management Plan.
Okay. I will say while we're changing hands, I am considering issuing an invoice from the committee to the federal government to take part of their proceeds from the Moonlight Fire settlement, their ill-gotten money in California, to pay back the damages in Oregon. But that might be something within this committee's jurisdiction, I think. I may not pay it, but we could issue it.
Nancy did.
That's as bad as sending the federal government a bill. Same thing. It's nowhere.
Just send a bill.
Just send a bill. Yeah, right.
Just issue them from Beth.
Now, Beth, write those out.
Would you please? On here.
Yeah, have a quick.
I'll sign them.
It's our collections business. That'd be great.
Good morning, members of the co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Mike Borderlon. I'm the division chief for State Forest. I've worked for the Forestry Department 26 years, principally in State Forest, at the field level and now at the policy level, so appreciate the opportunity to provide you an update on State Forest. And I'll start with some background and review information, and then I'll move into sort of the current issues associated with our implementing our State Forest management plans. So State Forests comprise a fairly small but important part of the 28 million acre forest landscape in Oregon. We're about 3% of that land base, about 820,000 acres. And I think you're familiar with some of the locations of State Forest. We have a very significant block of Board of Forestry ownership in the northwest part of the state, the Tillamook Burn. I might add that Tillamook Burn actually happened on a day somewhat like today, when we had east winds blowing in late August. So we're also very concerned about fire protection on state forest lands. So we manage two types of properties. We manage Board of Forestry lands, and those lands were lands that were deeded to the state from the counties. These were tax delinquent properties that were burned over in the Tillamook fires or other fires or cutovers, and they reverted to the counties. counties then deeded those lands to the state, and the counties retained a protected and recognizable interest in these lands. So we have a close working relationship with the trust land counties and the county commissioners in these areas where we have state forest lands. 684,000 acres of the total here is in Board of Forestry ownership. The other type of lands we manage through an agreement with the Department of State Lands are the common school forest lands. Those lands were originally lands that were owned by the federal government when Oregon was admitted to the Union. These lands were then deeded to the state. The majority of these common school forest lands were consolidated in a block known as the Elliott State Forest in southern Oregon. I think you're familiar with the Elliott State Forest as well. So there's 96,000 acres in one block. Almost all of that is common school forest lands. These two types of lands have legal mandates, and I'll cover that very quickly here. Board of Forestry lands, the statutory mandate for Board of Forestry lands is that we manage these lands to secure the greatest permanent value of those lands to the state. The Board of Forestry in 1998 further interpreted what does greatest permanent value mean, and the board interpreted that to be healthy, productive, sustainable forest, which provide a full range of economic, social, and environmental benefits. The board went on to also say within that administrative rule that these lands would be actively managed to produce timber and revenues for the states, counties, and local taxing districts. So that active management component is a management focus on state forest lands, on Board of Forestry lands. And that's an important component that helps us build forest management plans. On common school forest lands, there's a constitutional mandate here to obtain the greatest benefit for the people of the state, consistent with the conservation of this resource under sound techniques of land management. That verbiage was interpreted through the Attorney General's office in 1994 to mean maximize revenues over the long term, consistent with sound techniques of land and timber management. So as we manage these lands through an agreement with the Department of State Lands, and these lands are under the jurisdiction of the State Land Board, we certainly keep that constitutional mandate in mind. So we carry out these legal mandates through forest management plans. These are long-term strategic plans. There are two dominant plans in the state that comprise about 90% of the ownership. The Northwest Forest Management Plan, which again is that Northwest component of ownership we have there, about 650,000 acres, mostly Board of Forestry lands. That is under the jurisdiction of a plan which was originally approved in 2001 and then revised in 2010 by the Board of Forestry. And that revision included some changes by the Board of Forestry that reduced some of our longer-term targets around producing complex forest structure and that reduction was from a 50% target to a 40% target. What that did is provide some additional opportunities for timber harvest on those lands, basically. And then the Elliott State Forest Management Plan was also recently revised and approved by the State Land Board and by the Board of Forestry. Sort of key elements of that change was that the Elliott Forest Management Plan, when approved in 1995, included a habitat conservation plan for northern spotted owls. And a habitat conservation plan is an agreement with the federal government over protecting certain listed species, and in exchange for that agreement, there's an incidental take provision within that HCP. The state, working with the Department of State Lands, looked to modify that agreement on spotted owls to include multiple species. In the end, we were unsuccessful in making that happen. The State Land Board and the Department of Forestry went forward, developed a plan that complies with the federal ESA through a take avoidance provision. That's another way to comply with the Federal Endangered Species Act versus a habitat conservation plan. The net effect of that change on the Elliott State Forest Management Plan was a harvest level increase of about from 25 million board feet per year to about 40 million board feet per year. So a pretty significant increase in the harvest opportunities on the Elliott State Forest. So let's talk about some current issues as we look to implement these forest management plans. And I'll cover three issues. One is the financial situation, Department of Forestry, State Forest Program, given the timber recession, the recession that we're in. Secondly, exploring some alternative management plans and approaches for these lands in Northwest Oregon. And then third, just touch on some recent litigation that may have some impacts to us. So the financial situation for the State Forest Program, I think the committee knows we are self-supporting almost entirely from our share of the revenues from timber sales. So we have a, when we sell a timber sale and receive the proceeds, about two-thirds of those proceeds go to the county and local taxing districts. We retain one-third of those to reinvest in the management of state forest. The recession that we've been in has had a significant impact on these timber, or we call stumpage values. And I'll show you a graph here that illustrates that point. Therefore, the revenues to the state and also to the counties have been down here during the last several years. The State Forest Program saw this coming, and as our revenues started to drop, we took immediate action in fiscal year 10, which was July of 2009. We actually reduced our fiscal budgets and our staffing by about 30%. So we went through a pretty significant layoff process and reduced our fiscal budgets by a significant amount, which unfortunately is resulting in underfunding some pretty important elements of what we do. Recreation, education, interpretation. We have very minimal dollars for research and monitoring, and we've basically held that reduction level since 2009 to the present time. We have an operating fund, which we call the Forest Development Fund, and that fund balance, given this recession, is also sort of sliding down the hill, and I'll show you a representation of that. The other action we took was to put together an internal committee with some external folks to really look at some short-term recommendations and options to address the financial situation we're in, and that committee is wrapping up their work this November. Well, this chart basically shows the line on this chart are the stumpage values or the timber values over time. And you can see we had a high point there in 2005, 2006, somewhat over $350 per thousand board feet. As we slid into this recession, we dropped in value by about 40%, down to a little over $200 average stumpage per thousand in 2009. And we've been making a slow recovery from that low point, as you can see here. But the future is a bit uncertain in terms of, well, where does this go from here in terms of those values? It's, from our perspective, it's clearly linked with the broader national recovery, and it's linked with housing starts. The bars on this chart represent the harvest levels over time, and you can see that our harvest levels have remained fairly constant through some of our higher value times and through this recession as well. I think that has certainly an advantage of keeping dollars flowing to the counties, and it'll also help create and sustain some jobs during this recession that we've been in here for the last several years. This operating fund that I spoke about, the Forest Development Fund, this is basically a bank account that allows us to have some buffer with the volatility of timber markets. We establish a threshold level of about 6 months. We like to have a minimum of 6 months operating expense in that fund. And at this point in time, you can see that this fund has eroded from a high of slightly over 40 to around $10 million. So we're at a point now where we're about 4 months of operating expense within that fund. When we look out in time beyond 13, we look out to 2017 and make some projections, the fund balance continues to erode down to about $7.5 million, and at that point looks like it's going to stay there. But that also assumes that we hold with the budget reductions that we've taken, and which includes some significant underfunding of some of the important aspects of what we're doing. And that also assumes that our timber harvest levels are where they're at right now. So the second issue and opportunity, I should say, that I'll talk about here a little bit is to evaluate some alternative management approaches or management plans for Northwest Oregon. In 2001, the Board of Forestry adopted a forest management plan for these 650,000 acres, and we sort of labeled it the structure-based management approach. You may have heard that terminology. We've realized that there are some areas of improvement for this particular management approach. We had the governor come and talk to the Board of Forestry in November of last year. The governor made some recommendations to the Board of Forestry about moving forward in terms of state forest management. He suggested that we look at some alternative approaches to the way we're currently managing, including an approach which we've termed a zoned approach or a land allocation approach, which would be having some areas which focus on conservation values and having other areas that focus on timber values or timber emphasis. So that's a sort of a zoned approach. That's unlike what we're currently doing. We currently have sort of more of an integrated approach to management. So that's one suggestion that was brought forward by the governor. The governor also recommended we need to take a look at our business model for funding state forest in the context of looking for opportunities to diversify the revenue stream. We're funded about 98% through timber revenues. Over the longer term, it would be advantageous to have a little more diversification of that funding type. So the agency, the governor's office, the Board of Forestry, as we look ahead here to evaluate some different approaches, the list here basically talks through the opportunities for potential change. Timber harvest levels to the counties have been identified by the Board of Forestry through a performance measure as needing improvement. And the board set a target for us to improve the revenues to the counties in the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forest by 5 to 15%. This recent plan revision we went through in 2010 has allowed the harvest level to move up to the sort of the low end of that range. So we went up by about 5% as a result of that. There's not much more wiggle room within our current forest management plan, so we would have to make some major adjustments in that plan to achieve a higher level of revenues for the counties. Secondly, and I've mentioned this before, this improvement in our plan needs to provide enough revenue to the department so that we can have adequate funding for forest management activities, for research, monitoring, recreation, etc., and we're currently underfunding those activities. And third, and this sort of follows with the governor's recommendation, the current forest management plans provide a significant contribution to the protection and conservation of fish and wildlife habitat. This is inherent with the plans that we have. And at the same time, we don't really take credit for those contributions to those conservation values. So the board recently directed us to proceed with some work to look at relabeling and creating a little different framework here for those particular areas where we are already threatened and endangered species, some of these other places, riparian areas where we basically are trying to emphasize the conservation values, then we need to call them by a conservation name. So we're just starting a process here to relabel some of those areas to a conservation label versus a fairly obscure process that we have in place that really doesn't do a good job of representing what we're trying to do with those areas. And then third issue that I'd like to just touch on here is some recent litigation. I think the committee probably knows that we were sued by three environmental groups starting back in January of this year over allegations of take under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And this particular lawsuit affects the Elliott State Forest, mainly common school forest lands, but also Clatsop State Forest and Tillamook State Forest. So the Forestry Department has been involved in surveying for this particular listed seabird since this bird was listed in 1994, I believe. And we have been applying appropriate protection measures through that time. There's some implications here in this lawsuit to the state, but clearly to other non-federal or private landowners that are within the range of this species. So in that context, we have interveners in this court case from forest industry and also from the counties. So just summarize here in terms of where we are with state forests. State forests are not a large component of the Oregon forest landscape, but they're a very important component of that landscape. As I mentioned, we have an active management philosophy on these lands, and in that context, the state forests have been looked at as a model for federal forest land management, and I think there's certainly some appropriateness here in terms of what we've been able to achieve on state forest through an active management approach in comparison to some of the methodologies employed on federal lands. We have some pretty significant challenges here, financial, some litigation, et cetera, as we move forward. We have an outstanding working relationship with the Department of State Lands, with the counties. The Board of Forestry is, in my opinion, poised to take on these policy issues around alternative management approaches, and we look forward to working through these difficult issues. So with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, I would be happy to answer questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to express my appreciation for the increase in board feet off the Elliott State Forest. As a matter of fact, I'm very happy. It's not enough, but I'm grateful it's a step in the right direction. And as for the people that brought this lawsuit, you know, I think they hate the timber industry, and I think they should be denied the use of toilet paper because of it for a few days. And I would suggest they use soap, corn cobs, but they hate farmers too. But I was talking to a person in the timber industry who exports logs, raw logs, off private property. I understand we can't, state and federal. And he told me, and this was a number several months ago, I don't know what the commodity number is now, but they could sell raw logs at 1,000, and forgive me if I'm not using the right math or terms, but for 1,000 board feet, they could sell a raw log, that amount, to a local mill, state mill, for $380 for 1,000 board feet. But they could sell it overseas for $680 for 1,000 board feet. Is that accurate? Or is that in the, is that?
Representative Schaffler, members of the committee, the export market, and you're right, of course, we're prohibited from exporting raw logs from state forest land. There has been in the past a differential between the value for export logs and the value for domestic logs, and that difference sometimes is not very great at all, sort of depends on the supply and demand, and in some cases it's pretty significant, as you represent, and so it sort of ebbs and flows. What I have found interesting is that as the export market has increased and is increased over time here, that has also tended to affect the supply side, which has actually raised some of the domestic log prices. So we've actually, in some ways, benefited from that on state forest lands through increased stumpage values from export sale.
Mr. Chair, you know, I wonder how much more money we'd have if we were allowed to sell logs to foreign mills, how much more money we'd have in our general fund as a result of it. And eventually, we've discussed already, you know, mills are closing down all over the state. Eventually, there will be no infrastructure in some of these places at all. Where are we going to send that commodity then? And there are those, the people that brought that ill-advised lawsuit, they're happy about this. They think that's a good thing. They don't want mills operating. They're heartless people. They don't care about rural Oregon and the men and women that are out there providing for their families. But where are we going to sell these? I mean, we got how many millions of acres in federal and state land? Where are these logs going to go? That'll be a tough nut to crack. I don't ever see it happen in my lifetime, but I think we're losing out on an opportunity. If we're not allowed to mill lumber in this state as a result of stupid people, where are we going to go with this commodity? It's very frustrating. Thank you for I appreciate the Elliott State Forest action. That's really good. That's a good thing.
One quick Co-chair.
Where are you at in the aspect you talked about the harvest itself? Now, we had a bill in front of us that would have made it mandatory that the state forest be a timber harvest of 85% of its natural growth, which is 100%. Where are we today, percentage-wise? Because at that time, I believe the people testified said we were 55 to 60%. And you talked about an increase of 15%. So mm-hmm. Does that mean we're at 70%? What does that mean?
Representative Escobar, members of the committee, we have increased state forest harvest in Northwest Oregon by some margin, and you saw in the Elliott their harvest opportunities are fairly significantly up there. When I go back and look at the numbers here in terms of where are we in relation to what could be produced from these lands if they were managed by an industrial forest landowner, and that's a it's a one way of comparing this, right? We're at about 65 to 70% of that amount. So when we've done analysis and modeling to try to develop forest management plans, that's about where we end up coming out, in the 65 to 70% range, and that's about where we're at right now. So as we move forward with looking at alternative management approaches in Northwest Oregon, for example, and if we're going to try to continue to increase those revenues to the counties and make and produce enough money to keep the department viable, then there's some opportunity there for some increase.
Yeah, so that means that we are not harvesting to the potential we can harvest.
Right. The sustainable harvest level is, from my perspective, is a somewhat difficult term to sort of think about. And I say that in the context that we have policy objectives we're trying to achieve here. And the sustainable harvest level is in the context of those objectives. So where I draw a distinction here on state forest lands versus an industrial forest management, in other words, why would we be harvesting less would be the question. To me, it's things like we have different management objectives on state forest lands. We have a broader set of objectives that include economic, social, and environmental values, which the Board of Forestry tries to balance here relative to achieving greatest permanent value. I'll give you an example. We're focused in Northwest Oregon under the current plan to diversify these young forests. These are forests that resulted from the Tillamook fires. And part of what we're trying to do is to have a mix of age classes and forest types. 30 to 40% of that would be in an older type that is, we call it layered or older forest structure. In order to get to that place, there is a sacrifice on the timber harvest side of the equation in order to produce those type of stands. And we've looked at the research associated with this, and there's about a 20% difference between what you could do with an industrial approach and an approach where you're trying to produce those structures. Those those forest structures have a wildlife value to them. So part of the objectives for state forest lands is to produce a diversity of wildlife habitats across our landscape. There's basically a trade-off here when we do that with timber harvest levels. So those are the policy choices that the Board of Forestry wrestles with as we bring forest management plans forward.
Keyword is choice.
What's that?
Keyword is choice.
It's definitely a policy choice here.
Right. Thank you.
Vice Chair Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your report, too. It's very thorough, but the key word, I think, in what you were just referring to was balance. Yeah. And I think that some of us would make the contention that we've gotten out of balance, mm-hmm. as it's and it has become defined in a different way,
right.
That I think is advocating for values that I don't necessarily believe that are good for all Oregonians, i.e. the economy of Oregon. I get back to, I think, your original slide, which talked about the overall philosophy behind the managing the state forces for the highest public good or whatever, mm-hmm. some sort of verbiage to that effect. But we have difficulty defining that in a way that I think is healthy for Oregon's economy. But, you know, and I would get back to the bill that we passed out of committee last February, unanimously, I might agree, that called for just sustainable harvest at a whatever level it was. But the testimony that, to me, was most powerful was from Lori Satinspiel, bless her heart, from Oregon School Board Association, who got up there and said, you know, the best thing we can do for kids' education in Oregon is to ensure that their parents have jobs. And if we can do things in this state to put more people back to work, the social benefits go way beyond just simply what price we get at the stump. It's in self-esteem. It's the social benefits of having people with showing up for work, having a paycheck, and how that trickles down in the social fabric has gotten completely lost in this discussion. So I'm not pointing fingers at you, but I just think as Oregonians, we really need to move with all deliberate speed to utilize the resources we have. Every day we go by, we have more and more people on food stamps, and I just don't think that's a recipe that we all would say that this equals the Oregon that we want to live in, the Oregon that we should have. So thanks for your time.
So you all have to manage, I'm thinking about how drastically different, obviously, private levels, state force levels, and then federal force levels, you know, down here. But everybody still has to manage under the same Endangered Species Act, right? So it's obviously possible to achieve higher levels under the same legal regime, which was part, I know, of the HCP versus take avoidance, where we tried HCP modification for like 9 or 10 years, finally gave up. It's all still within the Endangered Species Act context. And so, you know, it's certainly my hope that we don't have to wait for, you know, Federal Endangered Species Act reform to be able to get, at some point, Tom and the governor to have a success in achieving federal forest level reform. You know, the things obviously within our control. We've had testimony before in front of this committee that I think most of us here would find a reasonable value other than timber production, like making sure there's good hunting opportunities. Most of us are pretty interested in that, but that's not a 25% threshold, I think. It's like, you know, we had some folks, and I think the Hunters Association, ODF, have talked about, you know, could we lighten up for one more year to get a little more habitat before we start the cycle to get a little more growth for the deer to feed on. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we get. I think it's the big gaps that we don't get. You know, a little bit of offsets for campgrounds and things that people like, that's not a big deal. But I don't think that's like the 25% or so difference between where we're at and as a state management regime and where private landowners are at. And then, of course, I won't blame you guys for the federal government. So.
And Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
And 70% of what? And you don't need to answer the question, but 70% of what? You know, it just, that I think the 100% number is wrong. I'm not blaming you, but the people that brought that lawsuit, they don't want people hunting either, Mr. Chair. And they don't care if our flesh tearing teeth fall out of our head. That's why they're against fluoride too.
Yes, fluoride finally made it into the building. It's been 4 or 5 years since we last had fluoride in the
thank
building.
You, longer than that.
I'm surprised we haven't seen it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Something that hasn't been mentioned today, though, is the receipts from these. And I have to say, most of the forests, state forests, is in my district. And the receipts also go to special service districts. I'm not, wouldn't call out just fire departments, stuff like that, but some fire departments charge a tax levy to their district residents, but some don't, and so they are reliant on, if they charge at all, for responses to accidents on highway, accidents in the woods. Almost everybody's cell phone has a GPS in it now, but the dispatching system is different depending on where you are, so time of response is different, and you're dealing with all volunteer fire departments, and it's you're at the luck of whoever happens to be close by at the time, or whoever's boss lets them go to a call off of work. But this is, I mean, I'm not trying to steer the conversation here, but pointing out that these departments are being asked to do more and more as far as training and stuff like that, that they have requirements on them. But these are the people who are going to save your life, you know, when you crash on the highways or have an accident in the woods or on the mountaintop. I can't tell you how many times our fire department plucks people off of Saddle Mountain, and it takes 5 hours, 5 hours. Climb up 3.5 miles in turnouts and take them off in basically a wheelbarrow. And, you know, these people do it. Their only money that comes to the department is in the form of grants, should they get them, and those are pretty much dried up now, or these forest receipts. And it's crucial to, I think, our area. A lot of the people who live there and stay there depend on these fire departments and EMS services, libraries, I mean, all kinds of things. As their receipt, and they have to budget on this, I don't know how they do it. I'm not a budget person, but they have to budget, you know, on forest sales, et cetera, so everything's way out in the future. And maybe they don't happen because of a lawsuit or because of whatever. And it's a very important part of the whole puzzle and fabric of these rural areas. And they are, in my district, I should have that number on the top of my head, all the fire districts in it, but it's a bunch. There are a lot. And some of them are combining now, but they're all volunteer. I mean, they have a couple of paid chiefs here and there, but I don't think people understand that when they slow down this activity in that sense. And it's just all part of the mm-hmm. whole picture, and it's very important to the rural economy and to the rural structure of our lives. Just a little comment. Thanks for all you do. Mike, you've been there forever, and Mr. Decker, you're a star. You know that.
You ready to move on to Gilchrist?
We are.
Good. Yep. Apparently, I'm 20 minutes behind now.
Yep. Okay. And so just for the process check, we'll ask for, you know, we'll get through this in about 10 minutes, and then we'll figure out where you'd like to go with the remaining time. Okay. So we're going to, you've asked us to talk a little bit about the Gilchrist State Forest, and so we want to provide an update. This is a new 43,000-acre state forest. It's located about 40 miles south of Bend along Highway 97. In Central Oregon. And so you'll recall that the Department of Forestry acquired the Gilchrist lands in 2010. We used lottery-backed bonds for that acquisition. And our focus was on providing revenues for Klamath County and for the surrounding communities, as well as environmental social values for all of Oregon. The Gilchrist is, we'll go forward to the next slide, and you can see kind of placing about 30, 35 miles south of Bend there, just south of Lapine, along Highway 97. The Gilchrist is surrounded by National Forest and Bureau of Land Management lands. It is a young and vigorously growing landscape consisting of ponderosa pine and lodgepole pine. It's located adjacent, as you can see, to the community of Gilchrist. And I would just also point out that Gilchrist is one of it is the only active lumber mill in northern Klamath County. It's one of the remaining important mills in eastern Oregon. Gilchrist is also one of Oregon's, it was Oregon's last company town as well. So the property has been had been privately owned by the Gilchrist Timber Company and the Gilchrist family since the mid-1920s, and was probably the one of the finest stands of privately managed, privately owned ponderosa pine in Oregon. The family-owned company sold the property in the early 1990s, and in the following years it was almost entirely harvested, and the new owner that purchased it from the Gilchrist family went bankrupt early in the early 00s. Following that bankruptcy, there was an out-of-state investment company that bought the property with an eye toward preparing to sell it off into minimum parcels. And even within the context of Oregon's land use law, they were able to essentially subdivide that into something like 200 individual lots that would probably go the pathway from forest land use to rural recreational, but would definitely go out of forest land use. And so the board's highest priority is keeping forest land as forest land. And so we set out to find a way to ensure that we'd be able to, that we or Oregon would be able to keep these lands, in forest use, and which led to the eventual acquisition of the lands. Governor Kulongowski and almost the entire community of Gilchrist turned out for the dedication in June of 2010 there in the lower left-hand corner. We knew that under the state management of these lands, if we could keep them in forest lands, they could eventually provide up to $1 million per year in direct economic benefits to the surrounding communities and to Klamath County. We were able to make that acquisition. So since 2010, in addition to beginning our management activities on the landscape, which Mike is going to talk about in a moment, we've continued to focus on completing the overall acquisition. The total Gilchrist Timber Company ownership was about 69,000 acres. We acquired the first piece, which we were able to afford using the lottery-backed bonds. Governor Kitzhaber led a successful effort last session to add some additional lottery bond authority. We are near the top of a national priority list to receive federal forest legacy funding to acquire a significant remaining parcel. All of the light blue land on the left is lands that are today's current Gilchrist State Forest, and the slide basically shows the various phases of acquisition to be able to complete that full 69,000 acres. So since acquisition, our focus has been on learning the landscape, on connecting with the surrounding community, and I would just point out here that the acquisition process, during the acquisition process, we spent a significant amount of energy, time, and focus working with the local communities, with the local counties, there was a strong, I would call it a groundswell of support at the local level for the state's acquisition of these lands in hopes of one day returning value to the local community. Learning the landscape, connecting with the community, the forest users who are using that property, recreationists, and also just kind of beginning a management regime with an eye to the future. So Mike's going to quickly kind of talk us through some of the current activities out there on the Gilchrist State Forest. Mike?
Okay, thanks, Doug. So State Forest, we have considerable experience with taking burned over, cut over lands and restoring those lands, and so we're thrilled to have Gilchrist State Forest. This is a young, overstocked forest, but it's got tremendous potential, and we know it's got tremendous potential because we manage the Sun Pass State Forest, which is directly south of Gilchrist, 20,000 acres. In the 1940s, we acquired Sun Pass State Forest. It was completely cut over and high-graded forest area. And I'll show you a picture here at the end in terms of what Sun Pass State Forest looks like now, and it's generating significant economic returns and social values as well. So our goal here for the Gilchrist State Forest is to create a healthy, productive forest that's resistant to insect and disease and resistant to fire as well. The principal tool here is thinning, and this slide shows a before and after thinning project that we've done. In 2012, we conducted a thinning several projects totaling almost 2,000 acres, and we did this through a timber sale contract. This was a fuels reduction project and a thinning. There was some saw timber involved, as you can see here. This was done right along Highway 97, right up against the town of Crescent and Gilchrist. So a very successful project in the context that we more than broke even on all of this work. We actually generated about $25,000. It would have cost us about $500 an acre to treat this property. So we figured out a way to get it done. And as we look forward, we're also targeting about that same amount of property per year. We'd like to be able to go in and thin these young forests. They really need to be thinned out. Mm-hmm. About 2,000 acres a year on our current ownership. That'd be about a 20-year time horizon for us to work our way through the current Gilchrist State Forest. This is very dependent on the prices for forest products. If chip prices remain up, then we've got an opportunity to cost-effectively go in here and do this thinning. If chip prices are low, it makes it much more difficult to do this. So that's one of the factors that we have to consider. So as we look, as I mentioned, Sun Pass State Forest, so as we look ahead as a vision for the Gilchrist State Forest, this is a fairly recent photograph of the Sun Pass State Forest. We practice uneven age management on this 20,000-acre track. We produce about 8 to 10 million board feet per year off of this property. we return about $1 million a year to Klamath County as well. So this provides great recreational opportunities for folks, wildlife habitat, and has been a great success story. This is about 30 to 50 years out for the Gilchrist State Forest. So we're used to thinking longer term. With the age of the current forest stands on Gilchrist, in 30 to 50 years, we'll be looking at something like this. Questions, Mr. Chair?
Co-Chair Esquivel.
On your thinning process there, what I think I saw in the first part was a lot of lodgepole, which yep. you have in mm-hmm. turn
right.
taken out and yep. left the ponderosa. Is that what the approach is?
Representative Esquivel, members of the committee, that's exactly right. Our focus is to take, this is heavily overstocked with lodgepole pine.
Well,
and we're
going to
end up with we want a mixed species here. We'd rather have more pine than lodgepole, more ponderosa. So we're focusing on taking out more lodgepole, encouraging ponderosa pine. Yes.
I think someone mentioned 1,000 logs per, or 1,000 trees per acre in one of our committees. Mm-hmm. I don't know yeah, which one it was,
exactly.
but that first picture tells you why.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Indeed.
So, the reason I really wanted to have you talk about this, not only actually to see how things were going, because it was this committee that passed the authorizing bonding authority originally. I will also make sure I remind Mr. Decker that your predecessor also committed to Representative Schaffler at the time. I don't think we made an amendment to the bill, but he committed that this would be managed under what we were at the time discussing, greatest permanent value to be timber production and not necessarily the way we manage some of the other state forests. And he committed that that would be done, otherwise we wouldn't have got the bill passed. So the legislative history is clear on that point, which it sounds like what you're doing. But my interest is, how are we doing, and I realize it's early, but how are we doing in the ability to essentially not have to feed this with other kinds of funds from the department, and from the harvesting and thinning and treatment activities, pay back the bonds, essentially? Are we able to do that without having to feed it, or does that take longer until you can make some real sales out of here? How's that look?
Chair Klein, members of the committee, perhaps what I could do is I might just talk about the bond and the acquisition piece. We might ask Mike to talk a little bit about the budget piece. These lands were purchased with lottery-backed bonds, and so the lottery essentially, it's basically like a 20-year mortgage. The lottery is basically paying off the bonds. So they're not direct revenue bonds that the sale of timber from the property is not obligated to pay those bonds back. It's the lottery. So in a way that the kind of in fact, really trying to, as you'll recall when we had the discussion about House Bill 2113, trying to come up with a revenue bond, we just couldn't make it pencil just because of the inventory that's out there, mm-hmm. The history of the lands. So the lottery-backed bonds was unique in our ability to be able to do that. Now, in terms of kind of annual operations and fiscal budgets relative to Eastern Oregon as well as Northwest Oregon, I think Mike could reflect on that for you.
So the Gilchrist State Forest doesn't offer many sort of commercial significant revenue opportunities at this point in time. Two fairly significant costs here. Fire protection costs in Eastern Oregon are fairly significant, around $3 an acre. And then our management costs for the Gilchrist are actually fairly small. We have one forester, basically, who's managing this entire property. So what we're trying to do is to keep our costs fairly low, look for opportunities like I demonstrated where we can actually get some work done and make a little money. Mm-hmm. And, similar to the Tillamook State Forest 40, 50 years ago, in some respects we've got to invest money to make money. Mm-hmm. So we need to invest some money right now in order to make some money here in about 30 years.
I would add that there is the revenue that we generate there on the Gilchrist per the distribution formula. The counties receive 2/3 of that revenue. It is a very modest level right now and will be for the next couple of decades. But the counties do receive that 2/3.
The reason I ask is, I am not overly optimistic that we're going to get a new change to federal forest policy in the next 2 years. I hope so, and I'll be working hard to try and get the
you know, the Walden, DeFazio, Schrader plan through. But one of my outside-the-box questions really is, could we make it pencil to offer to buy the federal forests or use eminent domain to try and take the federal forests, having to pay for them, obviously, but provide a financing mechanism either through revenue bonds or through lottery-backed bonds where we could make enough to pay back the acquisition of federal forests? Because obviously the federal government needs money, and I don't ever see how some suburban congressperson from Boston is going to ever vote to change anything that would benefit Oregon's logging communities. And so if there's a way to tap into their need for money and acquire federal lands, could we make our money back through management activities in those types of forests, where there are lots more board feet, you know, west side forests?
Representative Clem, I'll a member of the committee. This is probably speculation on my part, really. It depends on the purchase price of those properties. And if the purchase price is less than the value, sort of market value of the current timber, we probably have an opportunity to do that. For buying it at the current market value of the timber, I think we'd be challenged to do it. Secondly, we would need to be managing these lands under state legal mandates, right. Not under federal.
Yeah, right.
Otherwise, we could not make it work.
Right. Mm-mm. Yeah, it would have to be an interesting bargain. But if this other round doesn't work, that's going to be what I start pushing.
I think the key to the feasibility of it would be how much money we had to spend in order to get it to where it would flourish. Because right now I see some of the federal lands that are just atrociously mismanaged or not managed at all.
That would be a startup cost. I think, and I would definitely agree that I think the policy obstacle, you know, unless you change the policy sideboards for those lands, you know, anyone, any organization that's managing under those policy sideboards is going to face the same challenges that they have out there today.
The question is, if we owned it the way we do the state forests and all we were operating under then were just straight Endangered Species Act and NEPA, is that, do those also have to be changed, or are you talking about internal agency policies other than the federal law? Because we have to manage under the same laws they do.
Right. For me, it's really it's the overlying federal policy, right? That would need, I mean, kind of the federal land management policy,
yeah,
that would need,
yeah,
to change.
Yeah.
Not at the state level,
right?
Right. And county, actually, kind of, I've had several county commissioners that have approached me and, you know, and asked that question.
Yeah.
So
it's
in discussion.
Something we may certainly have to make
sure.
Mr.
Chair,
and obviously the state would gain all these additional benefits in terms of income tax revenue whenever you keep a mill open like you did in Gilchrist.
Right.
If we could get, I mean, that's probably not factored into your estimates of whether it would make money, but for us it would factor into our estimates of the revenues that would come in.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I think the federal property is worthless right now. It has no value. None. Economically has no, there's some obscure, abstract, greatest purpose value out there for some, but right now I'd have to say it's worthless. It's worth, as a matter of fact, it's damaging. It's burning up, carbon up in the air. It's a negative. If we owned it, the state owned it, which I think you do an excellent job of managing the forest relative to them, for sure, it would have some value if we had it. But right now, I would have to say it's worthless economically. It's
so
zero
to use
value.
Eminent domain to seize it, and then we could pay.
Exactly.
We'll use your appraised value. We'll use that as our legal basis for the rate we pay. Representative Schaffler assigned it a value of zero. That's what we're paying.
$0.
And we now own it. Thank you. We seize it as an area of critical concern.
In the Misery Loves Company department, I would say that this is the number one issue amongst my colleagues in the West. Other state foresters in the West are where there is a predominance of federal ownership. It's the number one topic, and you know, I'm actually meeting with NASF next week, and it is at the top of the list.
Mm. Let's keep it there. Good.
Yeah. Good.
Okay, thank you. We'll get into Sudden Oak Death, because I've now, with my wild conspiracy theory of how to get this land back, have screwed us up for another 10 minutes worth of
all right.
time.
So I believe Peter Daugherty, our Private Forest Division Chief, is here, joining us from the water quality discussion in the next room. And I think we have some folks from the Department of Agriculture, just mindful of your time as well. And so how would you like to apportion? We've got two remaining topics. We have our Private Forest Budget Implementation as well as Sudden Oak Death.
As long as we're out by 11, we're fine. So
okay.
That's 35 minutes. So we ought to shave 10 between
the
two.
Can we do that?
we're not going to allow the Oregon Duck, Jeff Stone, to come up and talk about sudden oak death, even though it is important to his industry. But he's not wearing beaver gear as requested for my birthday, so he's not going to be allowed to talk at all today.
The Stone's out.
My daughter's cheerleader outfit apparently didn't fit him, so we're going to find him a new beaver scarf or something for tonight's festivities.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So Peter's going to load up the next piece. I think we've got the handout that's working its way around. We're going to focus on sudden oak death and other invasives, and we're going to try to smush this a little bit down into about 15 minutes. So, Peter, do you want to take us away? Down the lower right-hand corner, we'll get you to the...
Good morning, Co-Chairs Clem and Esquivel and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Doherty, and I serve as the Private Forest Division Chief of the Department of Forestry. With me is Dan Hilburn, Administrator of the Department of Agriculture's Plant Division, and Lauren Henderson, who's the Assistant Director at the Department of Agriculture. We're here to provide an update on sudden oak death and a brief overview of some potential new forest invasive species. As we get started, I'd like to acknowledge Alan Kanaski, Oregon forest pathologist and leader of the Oregon Department's Forest Sudden Death Program. This is a cooperative effort with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon State University, the Forest Service, BLM, private landowners in Curry County, and many stakeholders. And this program's done a remarkable job of containing a new and little understood pathogen in the forest of southern Oregon. This team's efforts are being used as a model for future national responses. Sudden oak death is caused by the non-native pathogen Phythophthora ramorum, and that will actually be the last Latin word I use in my presentation. As you recall, sudden oak death has a broad host range, but in Oregon, tan oak drives the epidemic as it's highly susceptible and produces a lot of spores. Its origins remain unknown. There is a lag between the initial infection and the development of visible symptoms, and this lag is a real challenge for early detection and response because the disease can spread when it's non-symptomatic. There are a variety of ways it can spread, from short-term, from canopy drip, to long-distance dispersal from wind and wind-driven rain. Humans can also assist in dispersal. Sudden oak death was discovered in Oregon in 2001, but it was likely here in 1998 and 1999. We have not been able to definitively determine how the disease got to Oregon. Our sudden oak death program started as an eradication effort with five components, and today I'm only going to focus on the first three, survey and detection through treatment, discussing lessons learned and effectiveness of the program. The lessons learned and the effectiveness of the program has led to a transition from an eradication program to a slow the spread strategy. Sudden oak death was originally discovered by aerial survey and verified by ground checks. This approach served as our initial detection method, and as the program got established, we added ground scouting to discover lower crown infections that we couldn't see from the air. Later, we added stream baiting to provide earlier detection, but sometimes the disease is not detected by this method, even if it's there. And more recently, we learned that ground-based transect surveys can provide very early detection and find sites not visible from any of the other methods. And this is because the ground-based surveys can find understory tree and shrub infections that can't be detected by any other method. Delimitation of the infected sites and treatments are designed to completely eliminate the pathogen from an infected area. Early on, we defined treatment buffers of 100 to 300 feet, that's 1 to 6 acres, and we moved later to a standard 300-foot buffer of treatment, which is 6 acres. And more recently, we've concluded that 600-foot buffers or 26 acres are much more effective for containing the disease. Treatment is intensive and expensive, from $1,500 to $3,000 per acre. And that's because the treatment involves cutting and burning all key host species on the site. It also involves herbicide injections of the host trees prior to cutting, and then it requires follow-up planting and subsequent treatments. More than 4,000 acres have been treated in Oregon since the start of the program. So as I mentioned before, the eradication effort did not stop the spread, but it has slowed the spread. In 2001, we had 9 infected sites and a quarantine of 9 square miles. In 2009, the number of infected sites grew to 59 and the quarantine was 162 square miles. Delays in completing treatments allowed increased rates of spread. Some of the treatment delays are attributable to gaps in available funding, but we also learned that the lag between infection and detection was greater than thought, and our treatment areas were too small. In 2011, we began to see in that circle the intensification of the disease around untreated sites in the Dudley Creek area. Treatment in this area is really challenging, as it's a rural residential area and there are many ownerships, or treatment areas end up overlapping ownerships. The infestation up there at the top at Cape Sebastian was one of our first outlier sites, a big jump over out of the quarantine area. I think you heard about that at the last time we testified. A 92-acre treatment was completed in March of 2012 on this area with great cooperation from the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. The site was found on their lands, and no disease has shown up since that treatment. We're finding, however, that the disease often occurs near infested sites 1 or 2 years following treatment. And that's due to the detection lag period, treatment delays, and too small of treatment areas, as I discussed already. Now, getting to what we know right now, this is 2012, and the quarantine again has been increased. So far, as of August, we have 79 new infected sites. Some additional developments to think about include, we had a new introduction in the nursery. That's the second red dot there on the left. ODA completed the eradication protocol, and that's no longer a risk at that nursery. The disease is intensifying. It's hard. I apologize for that. That's Thompson Creek. That's the next cluster of dots above that Cape Flory, Dooley Creek area. The interesting thing about that is we found these sites with ground transect surveys, and we would not have detected them probably for 1 to 2 years if we relied solely on aerial survey. And then the last thing to note is there's a new emergency quarantine area on the lower right that resulted from an infestation at Wheeler Creek and East Fork Winnick on U.S. Forest Service land. And then something that we haven't seen on these, the red area is what we're calling the general infested areas. It no longer requires treatment, and I will discuss a little bit later how we address that.
In about 10 minutes.
Great. So just a real brief recap of the lessons learned so far in our eradication program. We need to use all 4 detection methods. New infestations found by ground survey indicate that treatment delay due to detection lag could be significant, more significant than we represented in the past. The treatment delays allow for increased rate of spreads, and we're learning that larger treatment areas are better at slowing the spread. So as I've mentioned, we have shifted from an eradication program to slow the spread strategy. We're continuing early detection and elimination of infected sites. We will treat the highest priority sites for spread. Those are the sites that are furthest away from the core area, subject to available resources. The BLM and the U.S. Forest Service has committed to treat all sites on their land. We have defined a general infested area, which no longer requires treatments, and we support disease reduction within this area through cost share for treatments and best management practices. We hope to minimize long distance spread through education and enforcement of the quarantine regulations. Finally, we encourage host removal through tannoc utilization and conversion in areas where the disease spread is likely. So in terms of where we're at, as of August, we have 380 acres outside the general infested area that require treatments. Treatment costs are estimated at just over $1 million. We currently have $400,000 in federal funds and $75,000 in state funds for treatment. This equates to about $345,000 available immediately for treating high priority sites, and the remaining $130,000, we have to find landowner match and a one-to-one match in order to treat those sites, and it may end up forcing us to use some of those funds to treat lower priority sites. So what's at risk? This is a map that shows land ownership. The green is federal lands, the blue is industrial forest land, and the yellow is private lands and non-industrial forest lands. And on the right side of the map is a risk map for the spread of the disease, where red, orange, yellow indicate very high, high, and moderate risk respectively. And so we can see where that quarantine area is, and we would expect that the likely path of spread is north and to the east in the red and orange areas. As it moves east, it's moving into federal lands, and they're still committed to eradicating this disease. They've moved to very large treatment areas and are doing a good job at that. As it moves north, it's going to be getting more into private lands, and there may be an opportunity above the Elk and Six Rivers, which is a fair distance up, to really stop the northern spread because of two things: the predominance of private forest lands there and the lower risk is where we begin to get into low-risk sites for the spread of the disease. So kind of a where do we go from here and applying, and one of the things is how do we apply what we've learned to the next unwanted species? And basically, we need to opt for larger and more aggressive response early on. We need to do what we can to minimize treatment delays, which means having an ability to organize, sustain detection, monitoring, and eradication early on. All of this would help if we had an easily mobilized emergency fund for invasive species. I would like to note that thanks to legislator support, the Department of Forestry was able to restore our invasive species capacity, and in partnership with the Forest Service, we recently hired a full-time invasive species specialist for forestry. This person will serve to complement, support, and expand ongoing cooperative efforts. His duties include managing and coordinating projects to detect, monitor, and manage invasive species, and developing strategies and tactics to prevent and mitigate damage. And I want to emphasize, this is additional capacity to our existing cooperative effort with our state and federal partners, particularly ODA and the USDA, in terms of monitoring for invasive species. Last year, Oregon conducted an emergency simulation using the Incident Command System for a new detection. It's a very good approach and worked well as an approach for addressing new invasive species. So, real quickly, these are some of the things that we're keeping our eye on. As I mentioned, we have a multifaceted cooperative detection program for many high-profile natives in Oregon. The ones on this list happen to be the ones that are of concern to forestry. Real quickly, sudden oak death and gypsy moth are currently the only ones that are found regularly, and we've eradicated gypsy moth on a couple of occasions. We haven't found the emerald ash borer, the Asian longhorn beetle, or the non-native Syrix here, but we have picked up a few other of the non-native wood-boring insects and defoliators, such as the granulate ambrosia beetle and the green alder sawfly. Now, of those that we've found, it was only one of these detections warranted eradication, and that was the case of the ambrosia beetle, which was a subject of a successful eradication project in the Dalles. It came in on untreated railroad ties from the southern United States. The project's actually the only successful eradication of an ambrosia beetle introduction in the United States and has garnered national attention. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dan to kind of wrap up the quarantine stuff and talk about nurseries.
Great. Good job, Peter. For the record, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm the Plant Program Area Director for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Just a few words on the quarantine, then an update on the second front for sudden oak death, which is the nursery industry. So the quarantine boundaries are expected to increase now as the disease moves faster. We're no longer in eradication mode. It's just going to happen. We'll slow the spread as best we can, but we can all expect that to move faster. There's an automatic 3-mile buffer around any new finds, and down in the southeast corner, you can see how it bumps out there. That's automatic. After the surveys are done this summer, we will be redoing the boundary through rulemaking, and you can expect that it will be a bigger box next time you see it. And we expect to do that on an annual basis from now on. On the nursery front, right now we're at about 2.2% of the nurseries that have host material have been found positive, so 11 out of about 500, which is a little bit up from past years. You can see the other recent years we've been in the 1 to 1.5%. It's still pretty rare in the nurseries. It's not a nursery problem for them. It's an issue because of the quarantines. And one other note there on the bottom, you can see that pre-notification is going to become just for positive nurseries. This is a federal requirement where nurseries that are shipping to other states right now are having to notify the receiving state of the material that's coming ahead of time. That'll ratchet down so that it'll just be the positive nurseries that have to do that. That's a good development. It was burdensome and it was causing a lot of unnecessary effort to go into looking at plant material that was low risk. Lessons learned on the nursery side. It's a rare disease in nurseries. As I mentioned, it wouldn't be a problem for nurseries if it weren't for the threat to the forest. It is very difficult to clean up in nurseries, and many of the nurseries that are positive tend to be positive for more than 1 year in spite of burning lots of plant material and cleaning up there behind the disease. It's still important as a quarantine disease. Other states care. Other countries care. They don't have it and they don't want it. Prevention is the best strategy. And best management practices do work in nurseries. And I've got two pictures there. You can guess which nursery is at risk from sudden oak death and which one is not going to have a problem with sudden oak death. So those are the slides. I just wanted to finish up with a real shout out to forestry. They have led this effort and have done, in my opinion, a fantastic job. They were dealt a very poor hand to start with, and the Department of Agriculture and Oregon State University and U.S. Forest Service have been feeding them cards as we can, but they haven't won the jackpot. They didn't do that, but they're still in the game, which is amazing after a decade, so congratulations to them. I think they've done well.
Senator Schaffer.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that sudden oak spread on the feathers of marble merlet.
Any ideas for the eradication yet?
Okay. I couldn't resist.
Any other questions about sudden oak death? Co-Chair Escobar.
It's not necessarily about sudden oak death, but it's about the
changing in the defensive methods we have to use in this state. We also have, you know, the zebra mussel shell is a real concern to us all. I guess we have feral hogs that are moving up north from California, and they just devastate a forest. The list just keeps on coming here, folks. In fact, I went to the National Sportsman's Caucus and found out the United States is spending about $125 billion a year on invasive species alone, all the states and everything. So that's an ongoing deal.
Hey, thank you very much. So we're in the home stretch here, and we've had a chance to look at basically all of the Department of Forestry's businesses this morning. Many of you, others in the room, and others who may be watching us have participated in the restoration of our forest practices program through your leadership. We have been fortunate in this last buy-in to be able to make some inroads in restoring our ability to enforce, administer the Forest Practices Act. I've asked Peter if he would kind of walk us through the restoration, as well as the work that we've done on complying with a couple of the budget notes that came with that increase in the last legislative session. Peter?
I'm going to move through this judiciously. So for stuff that's a little bit of a review, I'm going to be skipping. So if the slides go too fast for you, slow me down. But our division's purpose is to protect natural resources on private forest lands and to keep them healthy, intact, and working. Private working forests are a vital part of Oregon's natural resource infrastructure, contributing significantly to the quality of life enjoyed by all Oregonians. Sustaining and enhancing these forests are critical to meeting Oregon's needs, including consumer products, renewable energy, clean water, healthy watersheds, and jobs in rural communities. With a recent economics up and down, we're now finding ourselves in a rebuilding phase. We're not planning to rebuild the program as it's been in the past, but rather we're redefining, improving, and rethinking all the services we provide. Working on under our current budget, we are in the midst of a thorough business improvements review to look at changes that can be made to increase efficiency and effectiveness. Currently, we're focusing on our Forest Practice Act administration with an eye towards streamlining delivery using new technology and increasing customer service. As we previously discussed, so I'm going to go real fast here, we presented our budget implementation plan, which is a prudent approach to phase in resources. We've met with stakeholders, including the regional forest practice committees. We've completed phase one and phase two of the the rebuilding, which really focused on immediate boots on the ground. So we've now completed the hiring of 21 field foresters, some key specialists in wildlife biologists. And we're moving on currently into phase three, where we're evaluating capacity based on analysis and redesign of business processes, the cost of conducting an annual compliance audit, and core business functions. And we should complete this process by the end of this year. And so moving on to sort of legislative direction we receive, the department is currently laying the groundwork for an annual compliance audit of forest practices. This process was initiated to meet direction from a 2011 legislative budget note to contract out for compliance monitoring. We had been striving to develop an annual audit, and contracting it out is probably a really practical approach, and we're moving forward with that. The audit is needed to inform our legislative key performance measures, identify opportunities for landowner operator training, ensure consistent rule application in the field, support third-party certification reporting needs, and to inform our adaptive management. The primary goal of the audit is to determine a state to determine statewide compliance of forest practice rules and best management practices on non-federal land. Specific objectives include a statistically valid sample design and size that will allow estimation of compliance rate across different landownership types and across different geographic regions in the state. We're anticipating needing a sample size of about 200 post-operation sites. The initial focus will be on 57 specific rules for harvesting and road construction, and the scope of rules included in the audit will be expanded in future years. So we're starting focus narrow, and we'll expand as we repeat the audit over years. The audit program is being designed with specific repeatable protocols so that a third-party contractor can collect quantitative field data. Salem staff and stewardship foresters are currently testing those protocols to ensure that design works. Our stewardship foresters will be involved in the quality assurance, quality control portion of the audit and will perform checks on about 10% of the sites to ensure that data collection protocols were followed correctly. This QAQC also works as an infield training opportunity to improve consistency in rule application. We utilize a 2002 compliance study design using the protocols as a base and revising those as necessary to meet the contracting approach. We convened an external stakeholder review team to provide landowner, operator, and stakeholder input on the design, and we're also using an internal review team of stewardship foresters and field managers to provide input on the design protocols and compliance determinations. We expect to release a contract by the end of this year and have the audit going at the beginning of 2013. Budget note two, our second budget note, directed the department to contract out with an independent third party to assess and make recommendations on cost savings, efficiencies, and cost avoidances that can improve our forest practice administration. As previously reported, we selected a DAS approved service provider, Guiding Performance Solutions, and just took off on this to get it done as quickly as possible. Representative Jensen participated in the summer on this assessment to define the scope of it, as well as other legislators and stakeholders, including members of the Board of Forestry. We completed the review in the summer of 2011 and reported back to the legislator in November, 6 months ahead of schedule. Real basically, this assessment identified 27 business processes that we could improve upon. And we picked two of those as top priorities. We then followed up with those. We didn't stop at November. We followed up those, conducted some additional review events, Kaizen events with our contractor to redesign those two high priority processes, and then initiated a pilot project. And the kind of the pilot project is sort of the new stuff that you haven't heard. We had a number of goals for the pilot project. We really wanted to decrease the time it takes from when someone walks in our door till we say they're good to go on their operation. So decrease the lead time for review of notifications. Utilize administrative staff more efficiently so our field foresters are in the field more often. And then ensure inspections are conducted and enter in the system with greater consistency. We tested the process for 90 days in three field offices across the three regions of the state. 2 months into the pilot, we were pretty comfortable it was working, so we added three more offices. Key to this was we established monitoring metrics for improvements so that we could measure improvements as the process went along. And that was really helpful in convincing people that this was a better process once they started seeing that their performance was going up. So real briefly, across the six offices where we tested new processes, we saw improvements. This slide is the average improvements. We had a significant increase in notifications from the previous year, but we still had a significant decrease in the processing time, nearly a 30% decrease in processing time. We had a 400% increase in the number of inspections recorded, and we found that our field foresters were spending consistently more time in the field. Okay, and then while we're doing that, we're also beginning to implement a online notification system, which was also identified as an improvement need. We're in process of this. We've held a number of events with our customers, our landowner and operator community, to find out what their needs are. We then held events with our information technology staff and our forest practice staff to design the system. We're in the process of finalizing stakeholder outreach and getting the needs designed, and we should have a contract awarded by the end of 2012 for the beginning of the development of this system. So in closing, we listened to your legislative direction. We moved quickly. We're rebuilding the program in a thoughtful way. We're going to continue to collaborate with our many stakeholders to provide input and make sure that we're delivering the services that are needed in an efficient and effective way. And with that, I'll take any questions.
2 minutes worth of questions, max. What do we got?
I don't have time to talk.
What's for lunch?
All right. Thank you for the overall day. It was very helpful. We even threw in a couple curveballs in the beginning that you weren't expecting, but we appreciate you, you know.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to present this, and would I re-extend the offer to, you know, as fire season takes its twists and turns here over the next month or so, if any of you are interested in getting out to have a first-hand look at a fire, we'd be glad to host you. So let us know. Thank you.
Not a question, but the observation and something for us to think about and continue to follow. I appreciate the work you've done on the budget note. You know, there's a lot of folks don't put a lot of credibility into budget notes, but I think this is an example of where the budget note is written correctly, work with the department, you know, correctly. You can begin to see some results from it. And I'm really optimistic that, you know, that we keep pushing this envelope ahead and forward, and I think if we do, we're going to find some real good rewards in the, you know, in the forestries, in the forests in this state. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you for spending some of your summer working on this. That's above and beyond the call of duty.
It's what you call the big bucks.
That's right.
The big bucks.
There you go.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you.